Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 298. I'm your host once again, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, Guillaume Veillette.
Coming across as belligerent, strangely.
No, you're not. John Lindemann is back.
I wouldn't say I'm with you always, Johnny.
You're always in my heart. And James Jones.
I was the host.
Yes, James did a great job.
The once and forever host.
You guys really did a great job last week, and I want to apologize for my absence. I was in New York City, I was in Manhattan, and I just had a really nice overpriced dinner with my old college roommate who I was staying with. And we got done with dinner, and I had told him ahead of time, hey, I'm going to go back to your apartment at so-and-so time so I can do RFN. And he wasn't, you know, he was like, whatever you have to do. And I was like, no, this is really important to me. It's worth my 4 hours out of my vacation in New York City because I want to do this. It's a big deal. And so I had already convinced him, and I had made arrangements for Billy to be there because John was going to be missing it. And we had set up to even start a little bit late so that I could get back. And so I didn't have to rush through dinner, and Billy needed the help too. So anyway, I left him. He stayed in the city, to do something with his sister, to go out to, I don't know, whatever. And he, you know, he wasn't going to come back and do the show with me. So we split up. I spent more than half an hour traveling back to his apartment in Jersey across the river, got all the way back there and realized I didn't have a key to his apartment. I'd forgotten to ask, and he had forgotten to give me one. So it was totally my fault. You know, he forgot, but my responsibility. And I went through about 20 scenarios of possible ways that I could salvage the situation. I considered breaking into his apartment so I could do RFN.
I would have actually enjoyed an episode where Johnny gets arrested during Now Play.
Officer, can I keep my headset on while I get checked in?
The thing is, it would have taken over an hour for me to get back to the city, find him, get the key, and come all the way back to do the show. And we were already starting late. And I just said, there's just no way this is going to work out. You guys, I don't want to hold this up anymore. You guys are just going to have to go on without me. I was downtrodden. I mean, people were buying me drinks because I looked so depressed when I got back into the city. And I was really, really, really upset. And I was so glad to hear from James after it was over that everything went fine. I was so glad to listen to the episode and hear that it was fun and interesting. And I really appreciate you guys doing that. So all that out of the way, I did want to mention that next week there will not be an RFN because there's too many of us going to be out of town. It's a big mess. Guillaume won't be around to edit. So we're going to take the week off, but there may be something in its place. I don't want to say more than that because we're still planning and figuring out what's going on, but you may get something, instead of a normal episode of RFN. And in any case, we'll be back the week after that, and we'll start running up to episode 300, which is coming up very, very soon from now. And we do have some exciting big plans for 300.
So yeah, so actually next week what you're going to get is John and I making fun of everybody else who's ever done the show.
Anyway, I also wanted to mention, it didn't come up last week, even though the poll ended last Thursday, but a retroactive poll is over. We had lots of votes. Thanks everybody who participated in that. And the winning game, this was our second chance round, so this game's getting a second shot at retroactive, is going to be Wario Land 4. It's a Game Boy Advance game, but if you're a 3DS ambassador, which I was until very recently, you can play it on your 3DS as well. Luckily, I think I still have my GBA cartridge. I gotta look for it. But if I do, then I'll be okay because I can dig up an SP somewhere and play it on that. Anyway, that will probably come up after episode 300. Just don't want to rush it, in the meantime, and, it might give me time to figure out how I'm gonna play it too. So, love will find a way. We will talk about Wario Land 4 in a few weeks.
I don't want to ever hear the phrase "love will find a way" associated with Wario. Thank you.
I just had to sneak it in there. But I did want to note that even though it'll probably be a little while before we get to Wario Land 4, the forum thread where you can discuss it, leave your thoughts, impressions, ask questions of other people, compare your notes, whatever, will be in the forums by the time you hear this, and there'll be a link in the show notes. So if you want to go and contribute to the discussion on Wario Land 4, it is certainly a very interesting game from what I remember playing it 10 years ago. There will be a lot to say and discuss, and it's a platformer, so it's not a strategy RPG. Yay! I think it's going to be a really good retroactive, and you can go ahead and get started on it today by playing your copy of the game or finding your copy of the game and then posting in the forum thread. So definitely check that out and be a part of the show. Finally, new business. Not finally, it's only the first part of the podcast, but new business. So I alluded to it before, but, last Thursday was a rough day for me because not only did I miss recording my beloved podcast, I also lost my 3DS. And technically I lost it the night before at a concert, but I didn't realize it. Well, I realized it like when we got back early Thursday morning. I thought at the time I had a pretty good chance of finding it because we had rented a car that we still had access to. So I thought, oh, it's probably just in the car. We'll go check the car. It's nowhere to be found anywhere in the car. So it's not that. We went to a restaurant that we had gone to early in the morning. They had not seen it. So now I'm thinking, oh God, it's back at the concert venue, which is like 2 hours away. I'm not going to have time to go back there the rest of the trip. I called them. They hadn't found it, but they took my number down for all the good that did. It very possibly was stolen, quite frankly. I think more likely it just simply fell out of my pocket. I didn't intend to take it to the concert. It was one of those things where we went to the city to have lunch and ended up staying in the city so long that we never had time to go back and change clothes. And, you know, so I don't know where the hell it is. I will probably never find it. I'm trying to figure out what my options are for recovering the hundreds of dollars worth of digital downloads that I have on that thing, not to mention my ambassador games. And, I lost Kid Icarus, but that's okay. I was almost done with it anyway. I was like chapter 20 or something. So I don't really care about that. You know, it really sucks because right now I'm in this weird limbo of like, I was probably going to get a 3DS XL anyway. But I don't know that I can wait until August to replace my 3DS. And plus, I don't really, if I can work with my friends at Nintendo of America or whatever and like set up a special deal where they will port my licenses over, which they should do for everybody, then I'm going to have something for them to port those licenses to. And I probably don't want to wait till August to do that. So I'm thinking now, maybe I'll buy a used 3DS and just, you know, clear the data off of it. Have them port the licenses to that, use that until the XL comes out, and then just trade it in for the XL and do a system transfer. Well, not trade it in immediately, but buy the XL, do the system transfer, and then trade in my new old used 3DS.
So, like, if I read like that post on the forum correctly, like you'd need a police report if you're one of the little people.
A lot of people have been telling me that. I haven't actually tried calling the standard customer support line yet. Mm-hmm. But yeah, apparently that's the case. If you claim that you have lost or had your 3DS stolen, you know, they don't have any way to verify that it's actually been stolen. And so they don't want to clone your licenses and let you re-download all this stuff on a new system because they figure you might be scamming them and just, you know, trying to get your friend's system loaded up with all the games you've bought and then you can both play them for the price of one. Right. So I understand that there are certain safeguards in place. And the safeguard that Nintendo of America has chosen is that they want you to produce a police report showing that you reported your system lost or stolen. I guess the police would assume it's been stolen. Otherwise, you know. But if you've lost it, then you don't know what happened to it. So maybe it was stolen, right? Maybe you dropped it on the ground and then someone picked it up and that's why you can't find it because someone stole it off the ground.
Right. But like, would you have to go back to Manhattan to...
Yes. Well, that's the problem. I thought I could just call and get a police report, you know, report that it was lost over the phone, have them do a report. And then there's a thing on their website, the Nassau County, New York police website, where I could request a copy of the police report that was filed based on my reporting of the incident. but they told me I would have to come in person to do it. And it was not only on the other side of the city, it was in Long Island. So this was a very long way from where I was staying in New Jersey. It was just there was no practical way for me to get back over there within the same trip. And so now there's pretty much no chance of me getting a police report. So now if I get really lucky, over a week later after the incident, someone will find it at the concert venue and report it, and they'll call me and mail it to me. That I give about a 0% chance of happening. So I think I'm going to have to negotiate with Nintendo if I have any. I mean, I could always just buy a 3DS and, you know, just give up all the games that I downloaded and paid for. But like I said, it's easily over $100 worth of stuff, including games that I had bought literally days before, like, you know, Marvel Pinball and Bomb Monkey.
Right.
That sucks. Now, why do they require you to go there in person? Because somebody has to be there to actually take it down, or?
Probably because you have to sign the police report, like, as an affidavit.
Yeah, but like, you can't, like, get a PDF, print it out, fill it out, fax it to them or something?
They probably look at your ID and stuff too.
Yeah. That just sucks. That sucks, man.
Trust me, I have no interest in defrauding a local New York precinct, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
You might.
Of course, the hilarious thing is, like, I think it was literally the next day we posted the news on our website that at some point in the future, Nintendo is going to have a, like, single account system that keeps up with all of your game licenses that you've paid for. It'll start out on Wii U, and then eventually it will also support 3DS under the same umbrella account, which is the way it should have been from the start.
Yeah, just wait till that kicks in.
But do we know that that's going to mean that you don't need the police report then? Or are they still...
I imagine that means that there's going to be licenses that are activated and deactivated based on...
Right, it would be like the way Apple does it with your iTunes account, where you just say, well, this device that I had that I lost was associated with these licenses, but you guys know that. So I can go through your web interface and just unselect it and say, those licenses are no longer valid for that system. So whoever has my system can't use them anymore. And that then frees up those licenses. And I can now put a new serial number on there and apply it to the new system and say, this is my new system. I want to play that stuff. I mean, Apple's been doing this for years and years. It's not a big deal. But Nintendo is just way, way behind the curve on it. And, you know,
the thing is, though, that they would have to have some sort of mechanism for communicating to the device that, hey, you can't run these apps anymore.
Yeah, if only the 3DS could go on the internet.
Well, it can't always, or you could just turn it off. I mean, if you knew that the apps are going to be disabled, you could just turn off the Wi-Fi on your stolen 3DS and be like, aha, fuck you.
You could, but then you would never be able to use the wireless function.
I realize that, but it would be a while. It could be a long time. I'm just saying, there is some disadvantage here versus like an iPhone, which is constantly connected to the internet.
Right now, and I'll confess to this, but right now I'm basically trying to pull rank and be like, hey, Nintendo, I'm kind of a big deal, and if you don't help me fix this situation, I will be very unhappy, and I will tell all of my podcast listeners how unhappy I am about it and what a dismal process this has been to try to get it dealt with. And I don't want to blackmail them. But it's not blackmail. It's also, hey, I kind of need a 3DS to do my quote job on the podcast, like to have things to talk about. And also, you would probably like me to talk about 3DS on the podcast because it's good for you too. So I'm not asking them for a system or anything. I'll buy the damn system. I just want them to do what they should do for all of their customers, which is make the licenses portable.
Yeah, so for the people who can't say, like, hey, don't you know who I am? I'm Johnny Metz. You know, I'm the OG blogger mom.
Wow.
So for all those people, and there are many, you know, like, how safe should they feel right now
I don't feel safe after having the phrase OG blogger mom thrown around, so.
That's some of the funniest shit I've ever heard on this podcast. I'm not kidding you.
How scared should people be to start buying, like, $40 games? Downloadable.
You know what? I think they should be scared. I really do, because, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, I had 20 games that I paid for on this thing, but they were all like $5 each. So maybe not that big of a deal, right? I had some ambassador games that I never really paid for. So it's easy for me to chalk that up and say, whatever. You know, they're old NES games I wasn't really playing very much anyway. But yeah, if I had just paid $40 to download New Super Mario Bros. 2 and this happened, I would be incredibly upset. Well, here's the good news. The fact that Nintendo's going in this direction and that the digital content they're selling people is more and more and more valuable means there's going to be greater impetus for Nintendo to fix their shit. It's not happening very soon, it sounds like, but the reason that they are going to have to fix this is exactly the $40 download thing. It's exactly that. You have to have an account system because at some point, people's digital libraries are so valuable and they're so ethereal. You know, it's not like, you know, it's not like a disk that you always know it's there. People want to have some sense of security. And that's what the cloud is, right? The cloud is just security. It's a feeling that even if lightning strikes and wipes my hard drive, the things that I, it's not even that the things I've bought exist somewhere else. It's just that someone out there knows that I paid for that stuff and knows that I have the right to re-download it. And that's just a very straightforward industry standard relationship between a content provider and the customer. And Nintendo is just way behind everybody else on this. And they're catching up, but they're catching up a little too late for me. And if you end up buying a bunch of 3DS games in the fall and maybe even in the winter, it might be too late for you too if something bad happens to your 3DS at that time. So, I think people, I mean, having gone through this experience, yeah, I do kind of feel like it might be a little premature for people to be buying $40 games over their 3DS eShop because this system isn't in place. I mean, I'm totally behind the idea of these things being available, but am I gonna go out on my new 3DS or XL and spend $40 to download Mario on day one? No. I don't think so. Not until this policy's in place.
Right.
But yeah, that's kind of where things are right now. So hopefully, you know, in a couple weeks when we come back for the next episode, I'll have found something, at least like a temporary solution. Maybe I'll borrow a friend's or something like that. I don't know. Speaking about video games, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on any of these, but I did I was going to talk about all this last week, but a couple weeks ago, I did finally finish Xenoblade, and I've talked a whole lot about this game. I'm not going to bore you with the final details. I'm not going to spoil it for anybody either, but I had been sold an expectation by James and Greg about the magnitude of crazy that is this game's ending. And I wanted to comment on that a little bit, just in case other people might be slogging through the final hours of the game, which are probably some of the worst parts of the game in terms of balance and difficulty and the amount of time that they take to get through. The ending itself, as in the thing that plays after you beat the final boss and before the credits, is less than 5 minutes long. So don't go in there expecting like this big epic. I mean, I remember Final Fantasy VI had significantly longer ending than this. And that's a much shorter game as well, about half the length. So don't go in there expecting this epic, you know, epilogue where they, you know, tell you all this crazy stuff about what happens to all the characters.
Sure. No, but to be fair though, they had started resolving some of the threads during the final boss battle or in the interim before it.
Yes, that's true, which I like a lot. I like the final boss battle quite a bit. And I love the final area that you're actually playing through. And I think this is what you were referring to a little bit, James, when you were hyping this up, is not just the ending. It's not the cutscene right that you just watch. It's the whole ending sequence that you play through is really good. It's really beautiful. It looks totally different than anything else in the game. It's very surprising and just bizarre. And you're like, what the hell's going on? And it sort of, And for the big twist that is revealed in the final ending cutscene, the stuff you do before that, in a weird way, sort of prepares you for it a little bit. As you're going through it, you don't know what it means, you don't know why you're in this place, but it does sort of set up this really strange revelation that comes after you beat the final boss. And yeah, the revelation is really, really strange, but it's also dealt with very quickly, and it is not given a whole lot of context.
No, which in a way makes it kind of more bonkers because you're like, wait, how did you get to where we were from? Like, because it's
well, and the other kind of beautiful thing about it And you know, it wasn't really a letdown for me. I just wanted to let people know it's not a 15-minute psychedelic 2001 ending.
No, oh no, no, no. It's just the twist. The twist is so insane.
It is really strange. Yeah, and what I realized, what I appreciated more, kind of after the fact, as I thought about it, and I sort of reflect now a couple weeks later, is the whole game is this really elegant mixture. It's almost half and half fantasy and sci-fi.
Yeah, that's fair.
And that's maybe that's typical for anime, but I think most Japanese media, games or movies or whatever, to me, don't take either the fantasy or the sci-fi elements as far as Xenoblade does. And what I love is that it pushes both throughout the game. And especially early on, I felt like it was mostly a fantasy game. More like, you know, Final Fantasy is typically very fantasy-based. And over the years, they've added in certain games are more technological. They're a little bit more sci-fi.
12 and 8 are really, really tech. 12, 8, and 7 are really sci-fi-driven. But you look at 9, and it's very fantasy.
Right. Yeah. So they kind of go back and forth a lot. I really like the way Xenoblade mixes it because it's not even that, you know, it's not magitech, right? It's not that magic is powered by technology or the other way around.
Right.
It's just more that the fantasy elements and the sci-fi elements really feel like they peacefully coexist in this game. And what I love, the setup also is like, seems very clear. The Bionis is the fantasy and the Mechanis is the sci-fi. And over the course of the game, as you go to these places and you learn more about what they are and what's inside of them and how do they come to be there and what lives in them and how do they relate to each other and what is their history with each other, those lines become very blurred, very blurred. And I love that. I loved it.
It actually starts in the prologue sequence when the Mechanis has launched its first invasion of the Bionis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where the blurring starts, because now you have these very sci-fi enemies, basically these sentient robots.
True.
That are literally invading this verdant green natural pasture where everything's just a little bit magical.
Yeah.
And that's really where the blurring starts, but it's really at the end when these distinctions really start to break down.
Yeah, yeah. So that as a theme of the game, I think that's probably one of the biggest themes I will take away from this in the years to come, is this strange blending of fantasy and sci-fi that's really, it sounds stereotypical if you just say, oh, it's, you know, it's part fantasy, part sci-fi. The way it's actually executed in this game is unique and very interesting. So I appreciate it very much. And you know, overall, we're working on our top 10 Wii games of the whole generation right now as a site feature, and Xenoblade made my list. So
unquestionably,
for all the complaints that I've had over the past few weeks, and you know, there have been low points in the experience for me, but the high points are very high, and the game is frankly, not only is there nothing else like it on Wii, there's nothing else like it in the past 5 or 6 years at least.
No,
and in some ways, there's never been anything like it. So it really is a very special game. And if you love RPGs, I think you should absolutely play Xenoblade. Absolutely. It's amazing. But just be prepared. It was 75 hours for me. It's a big ass game. It takes
it's huge.
75 hours. It literally took me months and months and months to play through it. It's a big commitment.
It took me two weeks to play through it. I mean, think about that.
It's worth it. You're psychotic. You are absolutely out of your fucking mind.
No, I mean, think about the games I've burned through in much less time than that. I mean, yeah. I got through Radiant Historia in a week and a half.
Well, I mean, it's what I think is cool about it is, I mean, even, you know, I've played a lot of MMOs, and it, you know, it surprised me with a lot of the cool stuff it does, like the whole kind of like the friend sort of tree where
you can manage all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, like I'm used to the whole thing, like, you know, augmenting your armor with this and that, and I'm just, you know, I find myself just kind of saying, wow, this is really, really good. You know, a lot of RPGs these days, they're always like, the cool kind of thing is to be a throwback, but it's not a throwback. It's actually incorporating stuff that I haven't even seen before. Like, it's pulling stuff from other genres, like kind of massively multiplayer, but it's incorporating new stuff on top of that. So I'm really impressed by it. It's really good.
And the best trick that the game pulls off is what we have said from the very beginning, when James was just ranting about videos of this out of Japan, which is that the scale of the world is so impressive and so unlike anything that's being done on any platform.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And that trick never gets old. Nope. 75 hours into the game, I was still coming into environments that are so crazy and so different from anything else I'd seen and so big. And it just blew my mind every single time they did it. It never gets old. And part of the genius of it, and part of the thing that really, really impresses me about this game over many other JRPGs that I love, is that there is almost no filler in an incredibly long game. They almost never make you do anything more than once. Nope. Whether you're dying, whether you're traversing over land, you know, just cutscenes you can skip. There is almost nothing you ever have to do twice unless you really want to. There's no place you have to go more than once unless you really want to. So the amazing thing is, other than a couple of pockets where you do kind of have to grind, and those are unfortunate, but if you ignore those, 90% of the game is just fresh after fresh after fresh. It's just you're going to a place you've never been before, and you spend a little bit of time there, and you go to another place you've never been before, and it's just that, and it never stops. And that's what's so amazing, because I'm like, you know, why am I not sick of this game after 60 hours? Well, it's because they're still, after that much time, they're still giving me new experiences. Well,
and it's not just new territory you're coming across. I mean, you'll come in contact with these things that make you want to go back to areas. Or a good example is on the Mekonis field, is there's these enemies that only spawn later in the game. So when you go there, you know, everything should be, you know, piece of cake, but you'll just suddenly, like, basically the whole world starts to get dark around you, and this horrible thing has come up behind you, and now you're you're stuck in this incredibly unrelenting battle that feels like a boss fight. And you know, it's just because, all right, you wandered around and the Mekonis is kind of pissed at you, so this is what it threw at you. And like, I had to get an item from one of those things to finish an upgrade, and you know, I was hunting for it, and then when I was expecting it, it found me. And it was one of the most intense moments of the game, because suddenly I've basically got this fight that I can't end because I have to win it. But it's just, you know, otherwise I would have never gone back to this field. But finding this thing really made the return visit worth it.
Hmm. It, you know, it made me think back to the real early days of RPGs, you know, back in... some purists might say this isn't that early, but I would say like back in the NES era, you know, Final Fantasy and Dragon Warrior and stuff like that, Dragon Quest.
You and your graphics.
Right. The first generation of really graphical RPGs, Japanese RPGs. There was a stigma around RPGs that they had very low production values and they were fairly cheap to make, because they were so repetitive. They, you know, it was about these numbers creeping up. Which, you know, you can do in a computer program with almost no effort whatsoever. And so they didn't have to generate that many assets. They could kind of reuse, they'd give you this little place, but you kind of would just circle around the town over and over and over again. And the game would change ever so slightly. And if you were kind of captivated by that, then you could play these games for really long amounts of time, even though there's not that much in it, right? And the incredible thing about Xenoblade is just the complete opposite. It's so content dense that no one will ever see everything that's in this game.
Nope.
And it's still fucking ridiculously long. That's what amazes me about it. It's like, who makes this kind of game? Yeah, not to mention New Game Plus, which actually adds a lot of new features. And I mean, it's weird, like, as exhausted as I was having gone through the game, there was a little part of me that thought about starting a New Game Plus and actually trying to go through it. You know, I mean, I don't think it'll ever actually happen, but it's compelling enough that I at least considered it. It's an astounding video game, and I hope people will appreciate it, not only right now but in the years to come, for what it accomplishes.
I would try the New Game Plus. Spoilers: I think that everyone turns into dinosaurs.
Well, speaking of people turning into weird things, I also played the Mass Effect 3 Extended Cut DLC, which is free. You know, I love Mass Effect. I love Mass Effect 3. I am probably on board with the sentiment that Mass Effect 2 might be the best in the trilogy. I think it's slightly better, just in the storytelling and the overall feel of it. Even though Mass Effect 3 is technologically superior. But, you know, I had no problem with the ending of Mass Effect 3. I thought, it more or less delivered what I expected and what I wanted. So I had some trepidation, but also was too curious to not play through this free revision that the developers provided for the ending. And the real shitty part is you actually have to play through the end of the game again. And I'm not talking like the final boss. I'm talking like basically the last 2 hours of the game.
Does it change stuff starting there?
No. That's my problem with it. They do sprinkle in a couple of moments before the final cutscene. Just a couple. They're very minor, but potentially meaningful to certain people. But even those come in much later. I mean, there's a whole mission where you like invade the Cerberus headquarters, and it takes 45 minutes to an hour to go through, even if you put the difficulty on narrative, which is what I did, which means it's actually kind of hilarious. I'd never tried it before, but it means every shot that you fire will kill someone. And it also means that you can walk right up to the most difficult enemy in the game and just watch him beat you in the face, and it does virtually no damage. I mean, I think you would have to be mentally incapacitated to die in this mode.
Hey,
hilarious.
Hey. You would have to be a terrible video gamer.
But you still have to actually play the game, which takes time. Like, you have to go through these levels. You have to kill a certain number of enemies in this area before it lets you move on. And I'm thinking, I've kind of already done this. Could you guys just let me skip to the new part, please? You know, it's really kind of a waste of time. And when I finally got to the new part...
Shepard just dreamed of a unicorn?
No, I just had to laugh because I do really respect the developers for actually sticking to their guns. They didn't actually change the endings to it. It is called the extended cut, and really all they do is add a little bit more information about what happens, but they don't change the outcome. I mean, you come back to the decision point where you can choose your ending essentially. So you could choose a different one than you did the first time, but I wanted to compare apples to apples. So I chose the same path, to the ending that I did the first time I did it, because I want to see what did they actually change. Well, they added this slideshow of like CG artwork with one character narrating it, which is about the laziest thing that I could think that you could possibly do for an extended ending. It's basically the prologue to David Lynch's Dune, except it's not the David Lynch version, it's the Alan Smithy version that has like a 15-minute explanation at the beginning of what this world is and what the hell's going on.
Welcome to Arrakis!
It's like, it's all concept art with Virginia Madsen talking bodiless for like 15 minutes just so people understand it's hilarious. And that's almost what it is. It's not that long, but it's like, wow, you guys spent 3 months doing this? What the hell? But then after that, there is an actual cutscene that is still pretty simple, but it's meant to be emotional and convey a little more impact, to what happened. And it doesn't really give you that much more information about what happened to these characters. It's more like they don't ignore characters. They do at least show the characters that you love so much in the ending. So they don't pretend like they're just gone. It's just really not that big of a difference. And I would say, you know, if you're playing the game for the first time, let's say, you know, the Wii U version, if someone's going to play that and they've never played Mass Effect 3 before, you know, I'm sure they will just go ahead and include this content on the disc for the Wii U release. And I think, you know, this is a better ending. It's not a different ending, but it's slightly better than what they had before. But if you've already beaten the game, I honestly don't think it's worth the time. I mean, it's free, but I still don't actually think it's worth the time to go back through and do this. Just go to YouTube, whatever. I hate to do that because I do feel strongly in playing your games and not just watching your games, but the part that they put in here, there's nothing new to play. The only stuff they added is stuff to watch. And going through and actually playing through the whole end sequence again myself, it didn't really make it have a bigger impact on me. So I'd say just go watch it on YouTube. Save yourself the time. But of course, if you haven't played the game yet, you can look forward to seeing it for yourself the first time. And I think this is it's an improvement, but it's almost negligible. Really. Really not a big difference. Luckily, I didn't have a big problem with it in the first place. And I will skip the Walking Dead episode 2, except to say that it is awesome, just like the first part. And if you haven't started playing this yet, I think you should. So, John, did you want to talk about Wii Sports?
No, actually, well, that's just kind of what I've been doing for the past couple of weeks. I actually spent a week
in Florida. Wait, hold on. What is this Wii Sports?
I don't know. You may have heard of it.
Explain it in excruciating detail.
set aside the next 3 hours, Guillaume. It's going to be a hell of an edit. I apologize. Well, okay, so, yeah, we were staying at a condo for a week in Florida, and they just happened to have a Wii. And so, you know, we played some Wii Sports, and I don't really have too much to say about it aside from the fact that I found out how much I now suck at Wii Bowling. Also suck at Wii Golf, so mm-hmm. that was pretty good.
Well, the golf is pretty broken. Everybody sucks at the golf.
And the rest of the games, I bet you didn't play, or...
No, well, that's the thing. We only had one controller, so it was pretty ghetto. We couldn't do anything else. But actually, one game that I played a few weeks ago, I haven't gotten back to it. I picked it up and haven't had a chance to get back to it, is Lollipop Chainsaw.
Oh, shit.
Did you get the premium version that comes with the chainsaw?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I wish I did, because Lord knows there's people I would use it on. But
the crate for it, by the way, took up the entire desk at a GameStop the other day.
Can you use the Resident Evil 4 chainsaw GameCube controller to play it?
I don't know. I mean, let's put it this way. Like I said, it comes in this crate that took up an entire GameStop counter.
Yeah, so I picked it up for $360, and I kind of took a flyer on it. I didn't really know what I was going to get. I knew it was Suda, so I knew, you know, there would be a lot of blood and gore and whatever, but it's actually pretty good. I'm actually really enjoying it. It's very, very tongue-in-cheek. I mean, just ridiculous. I mean...
Well, I mean, it's called Lollipop Chainsaw, for God's sake. I didn't expect a serious exploration into the depths of mankind.
It's definitely not that. Yeah, I mean, the game starts off with, you know, you're this cheerleader girl, and she wakes up in the morning, and, you know, she, you know, goes to school, and, you know, her school's infested with zombies. I could say that I'm skipping story, but I'm really not, because there really isn't much of a story, and it doesn't make any sense anyways. But it turns out that her boyfriend, her love interest, who, you know, kind of professes his love for her at the start, but of course he gets killed by zombies, and she winds up, this is kind of a spoiler, but, I mean, it happens so early in the game. He winds up getting beheaded. He turns into a zombie. She winds up having to behead him, but then somehow, because she's this zombie, she's a cheerleader zombie hunter, she uses magic to keep his head alive, and she carries his head attached to her hip.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, I can see that.
It's perfectly normal.
To be fair, I regularly keep decapitated heads as my companions and, like, engage in various quests around town.
I think Suda stole this from the unproduced script of Weekend at Bernie's 3.
Well, hold on. Is she sticking her fingers up his neck hole to use him like a puppet? Because it's
no.
So, then yes, that is in fact...
No. She does not cross that line.
She doesn't call him Wilson, does she? I mean...
No. No, she's okay. Not. No, thankfully. There's no cribbing from Tom Hanks movies in this one. But... Yeah, so where this comes into gameplay is, I mean, your typical, you know, you are slicing up zombies as they, you know, come through, and you're going through a high school, and there's kind of set pieces like, you know, a bus will drive up that's driven by a zombie, and it turns over, bursts into flames, zombies come out, and then you kill them all. And so there's a lot of kind of stuff like that, but where your boyfriend or a dead, sort of dead boyfriend's head comes into play is puzzle solving. So what you can do is there will be a certain type of zombie that's kind of like glowing. But what you can do is you can take your boyfriend's head, put it on the zombie, and then you can control the zombie to, you know, do various kinds of things.
Oh, it's the master's baton. Perfect.
Yeah, it's completely bizarre. But they kind of liven things up. But, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff to unlock. Like you can unlock different skimpy costumes, of course.
Because the one that you start with is not enough.
Yeah, well, it's what's actually funny, because if you put the camera underneath her, like you're looking up her skirt, she actually covers up.
And you get a trophy, right? Or an achievement?
I don't know. Maybe if you do it a certain way, I'm not sure. But I'll have to go back and try, and I'll update you on it.
awesome.
I mean, I think the game is really well written. Like, they actually, like, the stuff that they say is completely humorous. Although the zombies say stuff that is ridiculous, completely absurd. Like, one of the zombies actually, I think, says, like, as you kill him, he says, "I'm going to fuck your father." Completely out of nowhere.
Is
completely
that a joke?
Out of nowhere. And so, it's just like.
So Who's the Mary Sue for Goichi Suda? The decapitated head or the zombies?
Probably the zombies.
Oh, okay.
Hey, John, I have a question for you. How many licks does it take to get to the to the chainsaw center of a lollipop chainsaw?
Yeah, well, you know, a one, a two, three. Three.
Yes. Yes.
Shouldn't your face have been buzzsawed off at the end of that?
Tag team, back again.
And
all right. Yeah, I do like that it is virtually impossible that any podcast will ever talk about this game seriously.
It's not, I mean, it's the least, one of the least serious games I've ever played.
Actually, I read in Destructoid, Jim Sterling wrote this long editorial about how the decapitated head of her boyfriend is really, like, the game turning misogyny on its head by basically objectifying the man for once, and literally.
Yeah, literally, they objectified yeah. him. Yes, yeah. He is an object yeah. attached to her hip.
But they do cut him off at, not even at the knees, at the neck, right out the gate. So, I mean, she is very much the one. I mean,
I am not going to tolerate the continued usage of puns here.
Even though, you know, she's kind of like what you would kind of cast as the dumb blonde, she's actually not, and he's the dumbass kind of thing. So it's really well done. But yeah, it's good. And I mean, you know, it's fun. I mean, there's really, you do nothing more than just, you know, slice through zombies, and there's some mini games and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it's just straight ahead arcade action. You can get new combos. You can unlock new combos. So you can do different kinds of attacks and stuff like that.
Did you end up paying $60 for it, or did you get a deal?
I got it pretty cheap.
Hmm.
So
yeah, I seem to see a lot of people just going around, like in podcasts, saying like, yeah, if you can get it, you know, if you can get a deal on it, go for it. And if not, wait.
Yeah.
That's what people said about Shadows of the Damned. As well.
Well, and to be fair, no one had to wait then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, I'd say it's because it's such a straight ahead kind of arcade type of experience. It's not trying to necessarily be deep, but it's just trying to. It's pretty entertaining though.
It's pretty much a straight port from, you know, your standard zombie slaying decapitation arcade cheerleader sim. I mean,
Yep.
The full body experience ones are the best though.
John, yeah. Serious question. Do you feel like this could be, you know, looked at as a sort of modern day take on Choiniki, and that the game itself is maybe not that great, but it's kind of hilarious and tongue in cheek and just so odd because of the presentation that you want to keep playing it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, like when you open up the store, it's like they play the old 50s song, you know, lollipop, lollipop, oh, la 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 la. It's like, okay. All right, and then you unlock more songs, and you know, you unlock a skimpy skirt and stuff like that. It's just so there's a lot of sarcastic kind of humor in it, and very much sort of like humor that pokes fun to the typical kind of cheerleader fantasy stuff. Like she's a cheerleader fantasy that you would think is really dumb, but she's actually really intelligent. Just, you know, completely goes against type. That's kind of like one of the underlying themes of the game is just kind of, it goes against type, what you would expect. Out of, like, you know, you have the outside package, but really, when you actually start playing the game, you realize that it really turns a lot of things on its head.
Stop with the puns!
Okay, so James is up next for new business.
Yeah, so I've been playing an RPG myself. Johnny has, but this is a reverse situation. I've actually been playing Tales of the Abyss. So I got a good deal on it used the other day. I bought it Sunday, and I've put on about, recording Thursday, I've put on about 11 hours.
Well, you're catching up to me, because I had about 20 hours on it, but no matter what happens with my 3DS, I don't think I'm getting those 20 hours back.
I think it saves on the cart.
Does it really?
Yeah, because mine had game save data on it.
Oh, well, that's very good news for me.
This game is still at retail, $40 game new.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a long-ass game, so, that, you know, your mileage may vary, but it's probably, you know, it's certainly got the length to justify a price like that. Now, to me, and I've talked about this little experiment before, when I buy a game used, I often look at how long the previous owner played it. And much to my kind of chagrin, the previous owner only played this game for 5 hours and then traded it in. And I kind of wonder, maybe you all can indulge me a minute here, but I kind of wonder what happens when you buy a game at that price and then just relinquish control of it so quickly. Obviously, if the game were really dreadful, I could see that. But I don't know that that's the case here. I guess it's just, it could be too too much, like it's just too bogged down in experience.
Maybe someone recommended it to him and it wasn't what he expected, or...
Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird situation, because I mean, 5 hours into this game, you're still going, churning through the exposition.
Oh, yeah. Tutorials and all.
Yeah, maybe that's the problem. Maybe someone just wasn't ready for that and was like, okay, when is the game starting, and just got fed up with it.
I can't imagine how much money they lost on that transaction, though.
Well, James, there's a point in Tales of the Abyss, you're probably not too far from it. And I'll be very curious to hear what you say about it once you get through it. But there's a point where you spend maybe an hour of the game in a situation where you're no longer controlling your main character in combat.
I'm there right now.
Okay. I found that was an improvement. And when that section of the game was over and I went back to the normal combat system, I actually had a little bit less interest in it than I did before.
So I haven't fought yet. So I'm no longer in control of my main character.
Okay.
Put it that way.
Yeah.
We haven't
you still move him around the map, but once you get into battle, it's just auto battle. And it made me realize that these battles look a lot more interesting than they feel to play, and that I actually enjoy just watching them play out. And you have like ogre battle type control, like you can use an item, you know.
Right.
But you can't actually directly control the character and tell them what to do. And all the other characters are always on automatic anyway. So the one piece of the battle that you really did have a lot of control over is taken away, and I found that I preferred it. So I think that maybe tells you where I'm at with the battle system in this series, is that it, you know, like having this almost 2D fighter kind of battle system in the Tales series for an RPG sounds more interesting and more fun than it actually is. But the great thing about a menu-based RPG battle system is that it's so abstract, it seems really simple and repetitive, but because it's so abstract, it's actually kind of hard to get sick of it. And when you give people direct control, it becomes a lot more obvious that you're doing the same shit over and over again.
It's, again, it's kind of a mileage may vary thing, because in the second Tales of Symphonia, its battle system is incredibly bland and generic. It's not nearly as varied as the original Tales of Symphonia, which makes no goddamn sense, because every character from the original game is in there plus two more. So, in theory, it should be more varied, but mm-hmm. It doesn't feel that way. But Tales of Vesperia, yeah. It feels better in part because the battles are more frenetic and the enemies act better. And the game, although Symphonia's got a 3D world, even Abyss is 3D, but Abyss tries to stay more linear on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
Vesperia very much encourages you to move in and out of the battlefield and rotate the camera and do stuff like that. So it doesn't feel quite as – it feels more like a brawler. But, you know, what I've done in the past is when I get bored, I just change the character I'm controlling. And sometimes that makes it a little bit better. But yeah, it's still like you can get stuck in these long dungeons that could go on for a really long time and just feel like I don't want to fight any more battles and just start avoiding them, because even the long battles against enemies will probably only last a minute, so it's a lot of time going in and out of battles, not even doing the actual fighting.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless, Tales of the Abyss in particular. It's kind of a weird game. It's one of the ones I haven't played.
Well, nobody on the PS2, pretty much nobody played it. I think Namco released about 10 copies in America.
Only really hardcore Tales fans played it.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's, you know, it's a weird situation, because if they had put it out on the GameCube, it probably would have done a lot better, which is weird. It's a weird thing to say, but it's true. Tales of Symphonia did remarkably well, actually, on GameCube.
Yes.
Tales of the Abyss, in my mind, and what I've always been told, is there's two trains of thoughts on it. One is that it's not as good as Symphonia. That it's in many ways, it's sort of like a slightly weaker title. And then the other is there's this train of thought that it's just a better game in terms of what it's trying to do plot-wise. I'm not that far that I can make that judgment. I know Symphonia's plot is fucking nuts. And then the sequel basically says, everything you just heard was wrong. That was actually space aliens.
Well, from what I remember of Symphonia, I would say the plot and the setting for Tales of the Abyss is more complicated. It's more complicated. It's more grandiose in the scope of it.
Yeah, Tales of the Abyss seems relatively straightforward in that regard. There's essentially two nations and they fucking hate each other, and there's a third nation.
That's yeah, but the metaphysics of the world they create boggling. I mean,
yeah, oh yeah. So as Johnny's alluded to in the past, basically the main character has no clue what the F is going on, and they have a story conceit why, Like, he doesn't know a goddamn thing.
Amnesia?
Yeah, amnesia.
Of course it's amnesia.
But at some point, you know, people will start talking and they'll just be going on and on about, you know, like the phonons and shit and unlocking your phone slots. And he'll just ask, what does that mean? Like, he'll just blatantly come out and say, what are you talking about?
And that's when the player says out loud, exactly.
And the game, in this really elaborate mechanism of trolling, has just made the character that you're kind of growing to hate because he's an asshole vocalize how you feel, which makes you feel like an asshole because you're agreeing with an asshole, only to have the other characters call him stupid and basically ignore his request for information.
Yeah, and you notice that all the other characters treat your main dude like shit.
And I think he's an asshole.
He's totally ignorant of the way the world works through no fault of his own. Right. And they all treat him like he's a complete fucking asshole, ignorant son of a bitch. And he's supposed to be your avatar. He is the character you're supposed to identify with because you don't know what's going on either. So every time all the other characters all talk down to him like he's a fucking idiot, it makes you feel the same way. It's like, what is this game trying to do?
It's the weirdest way I've ever bonded with a character I really hate. Like, I've bonded with him because we're stuck in this world we don't understand together.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the same time, I hate him because he's a prick. It's like, wow, this is an incredibly awkward situation I find myself in.
But you know what it
right
reminds
now?
Me of a little bit? Neku in The World Ends With You. A little bit like that.
A little bit, yeah. He's
a jerk, but he's your jerk.
Yeah, like you identify... But in Neku, it's weird because you identify with Neku because everyone around Neku is a fucking psychopath. So, like, you're true. Like, well, at least Neku's not crazy. The characters in Tales of the Abyss... Generally speaking, maybe two of the human characters are kind of jerks, but the majority of them are well-intentioned individuals that the character you're identifying with is constantly treating like a prick. It's like, even when they're trying to be nice to him, he's being a jerk to them. It's like, dude, stop it! Maybe they'll explain some shit to you so we can both understand. How he constantly talks bad to the little cute character. It's like, he's vocalizing how you feel about this character. Everybody's like, oh, he's so cute. And he's like, he's fucking annoying. Shut up, thing. And you're like, yes, I agree with you, but this isn't going to get the game explained to us. Behave yourself so that we can understand what's going on.
Yeah, the storytelling in Tales of the Abyss is just bizarre. It really is.
It's not, I can't say it's bad though, because like I'm invested in trying to make my main character not an asshole so people will tell him things. And the first time they tell him something, he goes and fucking blacks out.
Yeah.
It's like, game, go to hell, stop that. From a technical standpoint though, beyond just the complete insanity of this game's storytelling mechanisms, it's kind of a nice showcase what the 3DS is capable of, because this is a PS2 quality graphics. So clearly it can show those.
Without the PS2 quality load times.
Yes. There are some minor loading, but not really that bad. Mm. And the save takes forever, though, I've noticed.
It does.
The 3D effects, even though they were added post-production, actually work pretty well in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of environments where the 3D effect actually looks pretty cool. Now,
in the cutscenes especially, I don't know if they changed the camera angles for this version, but a lot of times the camera angle will be like up in a corner of a room, so you really get that diorama effect,
right,
where the 3D is showcased really nicely.
I think that's just happy coincidence. Tales games usually do that.
Yeah, it could be.
Now, what this game does make me feel good about, though, is, you know, it's a full Tales game. It's not like a hamstrung handheld experience. It, you know, you get all the things like economizing your items and how battles are actually more of an economic proposition than a combat one, because there's a certain point of like, well, life bottles are expensive as crap. Like, do I really want to win this battle having spent 10,000 gold on life bottles? Well, not really. All right, I'll just die and start over again. But the game itself is, you know, it's a really full-featured handheld experience. And Namco produced two of those on the DS in the Tales series. They produced Tales of Hearts, which never came out in the U.S. It's never been translated unofficially. And they produced Tales of the one I played. I can't remember its name now. There's a lot of fucking... Tales of Innocence.
Oh.
Actually, they produced Tales of... Yeah, there's Tales of the Tempest, Tales of Hearts, and Tales of Innocence. They produced three Tales games for the DS. And they're all actually supposed to be really good. And they look really good. Like, they really pushed the DS hard. So maybe they'll make an original one for the 3DS? That would be nice.
Oh, I think it's very likely that they will.
It would be a very nice thing for them to do. Let's put it that way. Because this is actually not a bad game for a handheld experience, because you can just close the lid.
Yeah.
Now, the only downside is that I have drained the battery on my 3DS since Sunday 3 times now. So it's becoming kind of an issue. But besides that, it's fine.
It's just probably because you're marathoning it, and it's probably something you do often on your 3DS.
No, it's not. I'm happy to have it, though, because it's a game that I can put real time into on my 3DS.
Yeah. Right. I agree. There aren't that many games on the system yet that are so meaty as this one. Like, if you really want something, you can just sink a lot. It's a great value, you know, but it's also like, if you really like the experience of just sitting down, even, you know, put on a TV series on Netflix and just let it run through episodes or whatever, just sit down and play for like 4 or 5 hours at a time. Yep. There aren't that many 3DS games you can really do that with. And this is one.
Yeah. It's really cool. I'm really happy to have it. Yeah. So Namco, if you're listening, please make more Tails games on the 3DS and not like another port.
Although I think they're going to do it whether you want them to or not.
That's fine. I know Tails Studio is kind of up and down, but go ahead. Even if they were to port something like Tales of Destiny over, which is another PS2 game, it's not regarded as being as good, but I would still buy it because it's a kind of experience you don't get on the 3DS right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I'm excited for what the 3DS can do from an RPG standpoint, having played this now.
Yeah.
But it's just, I'm hoping we get it soon.
Yeah, yeah. Especially the XL with having a little better battery life.
Yeah.
That'll help a bit.
Yep.
Okay, so Guillaume is going to wrap up new business for us.
Yeah, I basically played the opposite of long, meaty experiences that I can spend a lot of time on my 3DS. I bought originally when it came out Mutant Muds, and I played that pretty much like the whole way on a train trip to Toronto, which takes like 6 hours. But I didn't finish it then, and I think that by the end I was probably a little bit burned out, which I think is understandable. So I didn't really pick it up until now. And so I was at basically the last stage of the normal stages. And then I don't think this is a spoiler. They're kind of visible right away. There's 4 more levels that you unlock. Mm-hmm. So I was like I needed to complete 1 level before I could tackle those. And it's just, I remember that, you know, by the end, last time I played it, I was kind of disappointed by the way that Max, is that his name, Max? How he moved around and how, like, he didn't really have any inertia or anything like that. Like, basically, you press forward, you move forward, and then he immediately stops. And, like, it's not, thankfully, he's got a jetpack, which makes him a little bit more fun to move around. But if he didn't have that, probably like it wouldn't be as good a platformer as it is.
Yeah, well, are you in like the dark stages yet? Because I think you will very much appreciate the fact that he stops on a dime and doesn't have inertia.
By dark stages, what do you mean?
You know, like the Virtual Boy stuff, the Game Boy stuff.
Oh, yeah. But those, like, I kind of tackled as I went along. I mean, you find these secret exits or secret entrances, I should say, in each level. And yeah, like you've got these kind of Virtual Boy or Game Boy looking levels, like monochrome, red or greenish. And those are, I didn't find them really that much harder than the regular stages, but I think that means, like, that says more about how hard a regular stage is. Like, it's not an easy game. Definitely not. And I really appreciated that challenge, and I really came to appreciate the level design, especially towards the end. Like, it's not unfair. It's not cheap. Perhaps, like, the only thing that's cheap about the game is that you've got a time limit that doesn't really tell you when it's running out. So unless you're keeping an eye on the bottom screen where you see the timer run out, you're not going to notice. You don't get some sort of, audio cue or anything like that. Like, every enemy is really, you know, smartly placed so that it's possible to get past it or to kill it without it killing you. But it's going to be really, really hard to do. And, you better be prepared to, you know, try a level like a dozen times before you make it through and get everything.
I would say the one part that is cheap is, to me, the enemy placement when – it's not always, but when they put enemies off the screen who shoot at you because they can shoot you before you can see them. And you can also in most circumstances, you can also kill them before they can reach you if you know, if you equip a certain weapon or whatever. But you have to know that they're there. So that's relying on pure memorization. I mean, the first time you go through there, you will get hit because there's no way for you to know that that enemy's gonna shoot at you right as you try to jump over the gap. So that's a point where I feel like they can improve it on in the sequel, you know, just to make it more fair.
I didn't pay too much attention to that, but I think that usually when you can't see the enemy and he can shoot at you, like, that means that, you know, there's three levels, right? You've got the main path, and then you've got the foreground and the background, and you can jump between those. And so, like, basically, when you're making your way through the level, you can see sometimes, you get a preview of what's to come. Like, you can see in the background, oh, okay, there's these enemies, these things that I have to collect, I'm gonna go there at some point. And it's the same thing with the foreground. And I'm thinking perhaps that you're supposed to notice when an enemy is in the foreground, and you're supposed to remember that it's going to be there and that you're going to have to kill it before it kills you.
Well, what you're describing to me works the best when they show you like one of those secret entrances that you're looking for, or right, some of the diamond things that you have to collect if you want to unlock all the levels. That's really cool, because then it's like, wait, the stage is clearly showing me, they're giving me this free preview of this thing is over here, but I have no idea how to get to it. So then you start like jumping off of ledges, you know, and like doing weird stuff to try to figure out how am I supposed to get to it? And I love that stuff. That's really well done. And it's like something you don't really see in other games, because most other platformers don't use these different layers of the level design like Mutant Muds does.
And I guess one other thing that kind of artificially adds to the game, the game's length, is that you need these power-ups that you switch between to make it to certain of these secret doors. So, like, sometimes there's literally no way that you can actually reach that door, and might try, like, several different things, and, like, it just turns out that, oh, okay, you haven't unlocked that power-up yet, or you haven't equipped the right one. And so, like, this kind of, you know, like, having to switch out between different items all the time, like, exit and go back to the level and try it again. You know, I could have done without that, I suppose.
I thought you loved Demon's Crest.
In Demon's Crest, everything is kind of additive. Like, you only... It's kind of like Super Metroid. You just gain more powers. And when you switch out, you just go to a menu. You don't back out of a level.
That's very fair. And, I definitely think they should let you change the equipment in real time in Mutant Muds 2. But, you know, the idea that you see something and you don't yet have the ability unlocked to get to it is pretty common, you know, in games that you love. So,
yeah. Yeah, but it's just that sometimes it looks, you know, kind of like you're really convinced that you just missed something in the foreground or the background. And you're convinced that, oh, okay, I think... Like, there's gotta be a way to make it there, and it turns out that, I don't know, like, it doesn't really communicate that very well, that you're just missing an item sometimes, I think. And, like, I did finish the game, I really enjoyed it. I think that perhaps, like, if you're the type of person that, you know, enjoyed Mega Man games past, like, 2 and 3, that you still wanted, like, that same kind of challenge, but didn't really mind that it was not exactly original at that point, you're gonna have, you know, a lot of fun with Mutant Muds. But, you know, it's a little bit hard to recommend to people who are not fanatics of hard platformers, action platformers. you know, like, you really have to know what you're getting into. And, you know, there's a demo now, so go for it, try it, and if you don't enjoy what you're playing, it's, you probably know exactly what the full game has in store for you.
True. It'll probably be the game of the weekend pretty soon, I would guess.
I would guess so.
Might get it for a couple bucks off.
Yeah, probably, you know, from 8 to 5, as has been the case with Sakura Samurai, which is the other game that I've been playing. That game was on sale last week, and it's pretty good. It's pretty good, but I'm already, I think, at the end boss, so clearly it's a very short game, and it has less variation than Mutant Muds, that's for sure. like, Mutant Muds doesn't have a whole lot of enemy variety, but you can kind of forgive it because it's the enemies are, you know, in addition to good level design. In Sakura Samurai, you're always in arenas. Like, they're not really levels. There's no features to them. There's no, like, different elevations. There's no obstacles in your way. You're always, like, in the same arena that perhaps, like, they will look different because the background is different. But all of them are kind of the same, like, dimensions even. Like, they're all the same shape and, yeah, the same layout.
So this is like a Punch-Out game, right? But are you saying that you're in arenas where you can actually move around? You can control your character's movement?
Yeah, you move around, and the camera will basically automatically switch out to whichever enemy is attacking you at the time. So, yeah, you're tackling several enemies, but always one at a time. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, the combat is a little bit like Punch-Out in that you have to, you know, time your dodges and time your attacks in order to vanquish people. You know, unlike Punch-Out, which has, you know, like, it's all about the enemy variety and learning their patterns. You do have to learn patterns here, but the enemies are always the same. It basically becomes a game where you just have to not fail. You just have, like, at some point you know what you're supposed to do. You just have to keep doing it well. And so, like, it's not, like, it doesn't get more interesting as it goes along. You get power-ups, but all they do is make your blade stronger. And that means that you're gonna be, you know, you're gonna dispatch some enemies quicker. But the game stays the same throughout. And so, I don't know who to recommend this game to. Like, I mean, like, I wouldn't pay $8 for it. And I didn't back in, you know, back when it was $8. And now it's back to $8. So, I there's definitely other games I would look at first. I don't know. Like, it looks nice. I mean, and perhaps, like, there's perhaps something about the story that someone might like. Like, there's a kappa that, you know, gives you this cherry blossom tree blade or whatever. And every time you take a swing, you've got these cherry blossom petals just flying around. Like, there's no blood in the game. It's always, like, petals. It's, like, it looks good. It plays well, but it's not really that interesting of a game. And the problem carries on with, like, when the game tries to give you something additional to do. Like, there's these minigames that test, you know, what else, your reflexes and your timing. And, like, it will just be that kappa throwing, like, watermelons at you, and you have to swing the blade at the right time. These minigames just repeat, you know, they just get, you know, faster and faster. They don't get more interesting. I don't know, like, it doesn't seem like the game was really all that well thought out.
If it is sort of this, you know, samurai take on Punch-Out, I mean, Punch-Out, the big appeal of it is that every enemy had a kind of a different style, both graphically, mm-hmm. which is a huge part of the characterization of it, you know, these larger-than-life, sort of stereotypical, memorable...
Yeah, racistly, offensively, own style.
Memorable characters, whether you're offended or is kind of up to you, But all the characters are different, and they also had different fighting styles, and it really made you feel like you had to play the game differently for each opponent. You had to kind of relearn how to play the game every time you got into a battle. Does Sakura Samurai sort of hold up that part of it, or does it just sort of imitate it without actually capturing the essence of what makes a game like that really fun?
Yeah, that you probably touched on the problem here, because the enemies are all kind of interchangeable. Like, they all look the same. They don't really have any personality. They certainly don't say anything. And basically, it will be like, okay, guy with a sword, guy with a spear. Samurai-looking guy with a sword, samurai-looking guy with a spear. Samurai-looking guy with a flag on his back with a sword, and so on. Like, yeah. They're really just, like, new skins and slightly different patterns. Sometimes you have to dodge sideways because he's gonna, you know, like, kind of lunge at you. And sometimes you have to, you know, back off because he's gonna, you know, swing sideways. That's all the game is. And you just have to get good at being able to dodge at just the right time. Hmm. I'm enjoying it. I'm gonna finish it. I'm at the last boss right now, but it's not something I'm going to go back to.
Well, maybe things will get better in the sequel, which they'll inevitably call Sakurai Samurai. Right?
No.
Wrong. Right?
Am I right?
That's okay. Going to get edited out.
Please,
and
God.
You're
going to
thank me later.
I'm thanking you now.
Okay. So that's going to do it for new business. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, this week on Now Playing, we've got a review of Johnny Kung Fu. Neil says, it's a game and watch beat 'em up on 3DS. Aren't you glad you paid for that flashy 3D screen? Well, it got a 4.5, so probably not the game to judge it on.
I'm editorializing.
And we also have a review of the far superior game, Theatrhythm Final Fantasy. Nate Andrews says, OMG, Final Fantasy music is OMG. Actually, it's Uundan, or Elite Beat Agents, for Final Fantasy, and that's apparently pretty damn cool.
It's addictive as hell. I played a friend's copy, and I wanted to just take off with it.
My script may not accurately reflect the tenor of these reviews.
We got a 3DS XL FAQ by Neil. Got a question about the new Mammoth 3DS about to crash down on our heads from space, wiping out all life and setting the stage for the resurgence of reptiles. I didn't write this, by the way. We have answers, not that it will matter when we're all gone. That's philosophical. We got a review.
You're welcome.
We got a review, Pikmin 2. Alright, Carmine Red. Do you want to control Pikmin with your Wii Remote in advance of Pikmin 3? Now, if you live in the US, you can. And apparently it's good. Of course.
Or if you live in Europe, you could have done that years ago.
Yes.
All right, Andrew Brown brings us a review of Project Zero 2 Wii Edition. And this remake of Fatal Frame 2 for Wii isn't available in the US, boo NOA, but you can read how Andrew scares up a good time in this fun reimagining of the ghost hunting photography simulator.
That is a real genre.
Yep. It's a real profession, actually.
much like Shrimper.
Only in Japan.
All right. And Alex Kulafi brings us a review of Family Tennis 3D. Do you want a great 3D tennis game with Japanese qualities? Whatever Japanese qualities are. Do you hate Mario?
Very polite.
Well, Family Tennis 3D is exactly that. Not bad.
It's actually got a good review. I just wanted to throw in the 8 Mario commentary. We also have impressions of Guild 01 by Danny Bibbins. What happens when Yutsaito and Tatsumi Matsuda aren't kept from working together? Insanity. But also 2 of the 4 games in Level 5's Guild 01. An airport simulator named Airport and a high fantasy RPG named Crimson Shroud. Danny has impressions of both. I'll let you guess who created which of these games.
And we are back for listener mail, but you know who's not back? John Lindemann had to step out.
I killed him.
He's got important responsibilities to take care of, so we're going to excuse him a little early this week, but he'll be back soon. So for listener mail this week and every week, you can reach us at the email address rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Or you can go to the show notes for this episode, and there will be a link there as well. And we would love to hear from everybody. Actually, I think we have heard from most of you at some point or another.
Aww.
But feel free to write in again as well, of course. We do love to hear from everybody. So the first letter this week is from Pete. And Pete writes, so about the only thing that keeps me from buying a PS Vita, we're back to this, by the way.
It's all right. You may eject from the podcast now if you so choose.
No, this is, trust me, it gets to Nintendo. So Pete writes, so about the only thing that keeps me from buying a PS Vita is the system's appalling load times. It seems that the one thing Sony refuses to learn is that having to wait over 30 seconds, let alone minutes, to 30 minutes to get to a playable point in a fucking portable game is a no-go for the majority of their customers. It seems that through either smart design, stubbornness, or simply lagging tech, loading delays have never been a real problem in Nintendo's gaming ecosystem. That said, what are the chances that the Wii U is going to maintain this edge in the never-ending struggle between graphical fidelity and the time it takes to get assets off a disc? Microsoft uses a hard drive to keep load times under control, but so far Nintendo hasn't even hinted at anything but purely optional support for faster media, and only on USB 2.0 to boot. It's been over 5 years since the PS3's release, but how much faster will the non-branded Blu-ray drive powering the Wii U really be? Basically, the question of the day is, can I look forward to Nintendo staying on top of this matter, or are the quick loading days of the GameCube and all of its cart-based predecessors long over?
Cartridges obviously are faster, and even the 3DS really uses cartridges. So
it doesn't. I mean, the access times on 3DS cards are not as good as a real ROM-based cartridge.
But they're faster than discs. They're much faster than anything optical. The anything that comes that's not an optical disc obviously is going to be faster.
Mm-hmm.
There's just you don't have to move anything to get to it. The Vita, The Vita uses those little cards too, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, unless you've downloaded the game and then you end up with something on the Vita's onboard storage, which is Sony's proprietary memory cards, which are probably not the fastest thing in the world.
But they're solid state. I mean, they should be pretty fast. I mean, ultimately, the problem is, and 3DS has this too, I mean, you know, Guillaume, I'm sure, is very comfortable with load times in Marvel Pinball.
Yep.
And Zen Pinball 3D. And they're pretty bad. You know, they're 20, 30 seconds to load up a friggin' pinball table. Okay? Every time.
So is it like the transfer speed that's a bottleneck, or is it like the processing?
The thing is, it's unpacking. They've compressed data.
Yes.
To get a small download for whatever reason. Maybe that affects their price or the amount that.
Well, they pack it up so it takes up less space on your storage as well.
I don't think that's the main reason that Marvel Pinball is having to unpack data. I think it has to do with, you know, there may be. It may be part of the licensing agreement with the Nintendo that, you know, they take a certain percentage per size of the file or.
But why wouldn't it just unpack one time and be done? There's got to be a reason it stays packed.
Well, I don't think the 3DS firmware supports installing games in that way.
Yeah, but is it really installing? I'm not sure. I mean, I think there's something more to it than that. But the Wii U is going to have load times. It just is. I mean, there's nothing that can be done about it. It's inevitable. And, I mean, it's a physical device that has to spin to a spot on a disc to load data. And that's just the way it is. Now, whether or not that load time is controlled, you could do a certain amount of that in hardware architecture through buffering, having large cache to buffer data. You could do it in your game design. You can code your game in such a way that it preloads things at low capacity runtime.
Xenoblade does this in a really interesting way where the game prioritizes, it has sort of a priority checklist that it goes down in the order of things to load.
Yep.
So when you load your file, your save file in Xenoblade, it pulls up the game world and your character almost immediately. But it doesn't pull in the map. Or the menu system,
nope.
Or even some of the enemies, for instance, or a lot of the HUD, all that stuff kind of phases in one piece at a time over the next 10 to 15 seconds. But you don't necessarily care because you're already moving your character around and going where you want to go.
Yep.
So they get you into the game as fast as possible, even though the game is still loading that whole time. Really clever. It's really clever. And that's a lot of this comes down to you just got to have good programming. You know, I mean, all these systems operate on very similar technology these days in terms of access speeds and stuff like that. So the differences that you see in load times from one game to another are primarily down to just programming skill.
Yeah. Oh, and to an extent, the PS3 did have somewhat of a disadvantage because it's a relatively early generation Blu-ray drive and those were slower.
Yeah, it's slower than a super, 120 speed, you know, DVD drive in the 360 or whatever.
Yeah, and that's why a lot of the early complaints about the PS3 was when you compared the 360 version and the PS3 version of a game, 360 one would load and be going, and the PS3 one would still be loading for another 20 seconds.
And you notice those complaints are gone because
people have learned to adjust.
Yeah, they put a little more effort into the load times, and then they make up the gap.
And I think the consumer has adjusted a bit too. Now, interesting he brings up the GameCube because we've talked about how this is a deal with optical discs. But the GameCube is a smaller disk surface. I mean, mm-hmm. Nintendo said part of the reason they picked this disk is so it'd be faster to load. That's bullshit. They picked it so it'd be harder to pirate.
You're exactly right.
But it is a happy coincidence that, yeah, by making the disk surface smaller, there's less spots on the disk to check for the data.
Yes.
If you're searching for something on your tiny hard drive, you're going to find it faster than on a big one, even if the same amount of data is on it, because it still has to check all... Well, not on a Windows hard drive because it builds the key. But besides that, the hashing, if there's no hashing, it will find it faster.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of deal. There's no hashing, really, on your game disk because hashes are live. But the it's going to be a certain amount of loading that happens on these disks. There just is. And, you know, Metroid Prime had loading. You'd shoot a door while you're running from an enemy and the game's like, nope, haven't loaded that room yet. Hold on. And meanwhile, the enemy's coming up behind you and completely blasting your head off.
That's the thing, though. Like, sure, like there's we know that the reason why they stuck with cartridges with the N64 was not primarily for you know, to minimize load times, and we know like that it's not that's exactly the same thing with the GameCube.
It made for a nice story, didn't it? It made for a great it was a way that they spun it to make it feel like we're really making our highest priority is the experience that you, the gamer, has.
Oh, also your games are going to cost $80 because they're on a cartridge.
we hate load time so much that we're willing to drive away about 75% of our business because we hate load times that much. Bullshit. It's for business reasons.
Right. But they still like through their design try to minimize it as much as they can. So
yeah, they do. They you know, that's part of Nintendo's effort to put polish into their games, and other developers do it too.
But not all.
Yeah, but other developers, you know, often prioritize other aspects that you would call polish, you know, over the load times.
I mean, I had GameCube games that had excruciating load times. I mean, just unbelievable considering how little data actually fits on those discs.
That was about 1.5 gigs for the time it was respectable.
Yeah, but it was half as much as an Xbox game.
Well, yes.
Oh, that's a good example. Mega Man X Collection. Mega Man X Collection has a huge fucking load time. Why? It's Mega Man X Collection. It's ROMs on a disc. I don't know. It just does. Thanks, Capcom. You're the best.
It has to emulate the PS2 that's emulating the Super Nintendo.
That might actually be true.
It's just no matter what you cook it up as, it's bad programming. You know, load times, most load times are bad programming. Because the thing is, I mean, every system has to load data off whatever medium you put into it.
Right.
And that the amount of time that it takes to load that data, in most cases, is perceptible to the user. So the question is, what do you do with that time? Do you do something to distract them? Do you do something to load it in by phase? Do you do something to stream the data while they're already playing the game so that they almost never have to actually stop and literally just load for
right.
a while before you can move on to the next thing? There's many strategies you can deal with it, and a really great developer, including Nintendo, I would say especially Nintendo, will find creative ways to deal with that. But it's a fact of life.
Yeah, even on the cartridges, loading was still kind of a thing. I mean, you have the Metroid games that have loading built into them.
There's loading on GBA cartridges.
Oh, God, I know. Kid Icarus, fuck you. I know I talked about it last week with Reverence, but that game has serious-ass loading time. Now, one thing that you know, Pete mentions is that he doesn't know any mechanism Nintendo has for dealing with their downloading their games from a disc to the hard drive, but they will have download games on Wii U, like download retail games.
Sure.
And odds are a hard drive will run faster than an optical disc drive.
It does on 360.
And just in technology-wise, in general, it tends to. That's why...
I install my 360 games from the disc to my 360 hard drive so that they load faster. I still have to put the disc in to play it, but the benefit that you get in load times is worth it.
I mean, that's why old PC games would let you do minimum install or full install, and they would recommend the full, because it takes longer to load from a DVD than it does from a hard drive. And part of that is what I spoke about earlier with hard drive hashing. It's just more efficient to find the data. And part of it is just the machine is, it's, you know, it doesn't come off the spindle, so it can spin faster. The head can be heavier. It's, you know, it's a more rugged piece of hardware, so they can do more with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, and it's directly connected to the bus versus having to go through. And there's a lot of reasons why, but I mean, you could download your games and you'll get a faster response time on them in theory.
Yeah.
The same should go with the Vita, but it's because Sony has proprietary memory thing, and like Magic Gate is slow. So I don't know what the new Vita one is, but I know memory sticks were slow relative to other solid state memory systems.
I gotta say, like, even though, like, I don't want to look at the past with rose-colored glasses, but I really miss the days when you had, like, not as many splash screens and not as many loading times and could just put a game in and, you know, you were already playing.
Robin Hood Prince of Thieves didn't have any load times, but it had 100 splash screens.
Well, you know, if you're really sensitive to this, buy a gaming PC and put an SSD in it and load your games off of the SSD, because then... You talk about zero load times, dude. That shit is crazy.
I have a solid state drive at work, and it is absurd. I mean, we're talking Visual Studio 2010 comes up in seconds.
But they're really expensive, and they're limited capacity, and, you know, you probably have to do partitions and shit.
They're coming down / going up, but still, yeah, they are.
I think SSDs aren't quite ready for prime time in terms of being, like, a primary console storage medium. Maybe, like, in the next PlayStation, you know, maybe they'll kind of step out forward enough and be like, we think you're willing to spend $500 on this system if it has a, you know, 300 gig SSD in it that you can download all your games directly to it.
Oh, I mean, you're not. We're going to have to fire Kazurai again. Hold on.
What about the Wii U? Like, that 8 gig of storage, what is that going to be? Like, is it going to be as fast as a SSD or what?
It's if it's solid state, it's going to be fast. It might not be as fast as a SSD, but SSD is like special designed to be fast. I mean,
yeah, but they're also not going to give you enough flexibility on the way you can use that storage that you won't be able to use it like an SSD. Quite frankly, you're not going to be able to put that many downloaded games on it. I mean, you know, Cloudberry Kingdom is one thing, but if you want to download Pikmin 3. And store it on your 8 gigs of hard drive space.
Goodbye to your 8 gigs of hard drive space.
I don't think it's really optimized for that method, and also it's going to use up most, if not all, of your 8 gigs of internal storage. So, you know, so you probably don't want to do that. In fact, they might not even let you do that.
I wouldn't be surprised if they don't.
They might force you to install it to an external memory device, whether that's a thumb drive or a hard drive or whatever.
Right, kind of like how the 3DS just automatically saves everything to the SD card.
Right.
Yeah. Even though the 3DS has internal storage, but it uses that for system settings and firmware and stuff like that.
And DSiWare.
Right. And that's because of... archaic architecture. But yeah, I don't necessarily think that Wii U will let you install games to the internal storage. I think that's for Miiverse and for, you know, other Netflix and stuff like that it's going to ship with that you can't delete. So I think you'll put your save games on there for convenience, but I don't think you'll be able to install big, especially like big retail games to the internal storage.
No, I don't think they'll fit.
Yeah, they won't. Yeah, I mean, you might get one on there, but again, what's the point? So I don't think they're going to let you do that.
I want to download new games every time I want to change games.
No, I do think it's worth, I don't want to glaze over this little part that Pete snuck in here about how he thinks Wii U will have a non-branded Blu-ray drive. I don't think there is any confirmation that Wii U is using Blu-ray. In fact, I don't think it's actually using Blu-ray. I think it's a DVD drive.
Have they commented on what the drive is?
No. I think we can only speculate. Let me speculate for you. It's a DVD drive. It's way cheaper than a Blu-ray drive. Way cheaper. And it's a lot faster, which again, Nintendo does place some value on. They place more value on it being a cheaper component, but they do place some value on it having faster access speed than Blu-ray, and it does. So just like Xbox 360, I think Wii U will have a DVD drive. Now you can call that short-sighted, but
wait. It's not a normal DVD drive though, because their optical discs are 25 gigs, which is more than a DVD.
Okay, so that's kind of like a single layer Blu-ray. It may be proprietary, like sort of like the GameCube or the Dreamcast GD-ROM
or the Wii. I mean, they're all proprietary.
The Wii is not.
It's kind of
an encrypted DVD format. And it's not even that encrypted because it ain't that hard to pirate Wii games, right?
But it's not going to – it'll probably have its own letter like the RDs you were mentioning for the Dreamcast, but
– That was GD. GD-ROM.
Yeah. Well, fuck.
Yeah, and the GameCube was technically a proprietary format. They weren't literally mini DVDs, although they were – in terms of capacity, they were pretty close.
Right.
But yeah, so it may be some kind of a special Nintendo version of it for piracy reasons, but I don't think it'll be Blu-ray.
No. I mean, it might be a similar technology just because they can resource components, but they did say it was 25 gigabyte data. So I mean, PS3 games, single layer discs are 25 gig as well. So
yeah, but I think isn't MGS4 on a dual layer Blu-ray? I think there are dual layer PS3 games that are on like big 50 gig Blu-ray discs. I think.
Probably.
I think there are.
I'm sure there are.
Because 25 gigs is about the HD DVD capacity.
Yes.
And that was one of the big selling points back in that war between the formats, was that Blu-ray could actually hold a fair bit more than HD DVD, even though...
Yeah, HD DVD can hold 30.
At the time, it was more than anyone would actually ever need for anything, but...
Now, I've got a question about, like, the external hard drive for the Wii U. The PS3, you can change the hard drive, and it's like it's the regular laptop hard drive. And basically, though, it's locked at 5,500 RPM. And even if you were to put, like, a 7200 or even an SSD, which I think IGN tried, the speed is not going to increase.
Right.
So do we think, like, is that what's going to happen with the Wii U as well? Like, I know that the bottleneck is probably the USB 2.0. Like, you're not going to get SSD speeds with that.
No.
But, would there be, would Nintendo have a reason to lock the speed at,
Well, I think the main reason for PS3 is because I think 5,200 RPM was probably the fastest that existed when PS3 was designed. And there's some kind of firmware, limit. Just like with Wii, you know, in the early days of Wii, you could only use up to, what was it like?
2 gigs.
Was it only 2 gigs SD card? Jeez.
I think so, yeah.
And eventually they found a kind of clever way to get around that limit. But eventually that was more or less hardwired into the input output drivers of Wii. And so that's the reason that limit is, wasn't because they, you know, are ethically opposed to 4 gig SD cards. It's just,
I hate 6 gigs.
You know, at the time WiiWare didn't exist and they couldn't imagine why anybody would want more than 2 gigs of SD card storage. And also, why would anybody want to load games off the SD card? It's only for backup anyway, right? That's where the whole fridge cleaning thing came in. So over time, they were able to adapt to it. I think Sony just doesn't have that much motivation to put in the work to try to support faster hard drives because they just don't care.
Right. It's not that big of a get, to be honest. I mean, it's like, okay, we've upped it. Great.
But I think Wii U will support faster than 5,200 because it's 6 years later. They'll support whatever the kind of baseline standard speed is these days, and probably no faster than that. And if anything faster than that comes out, it won't matter because they're still going through USB 2.0.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is what it is at this point. And you know, I can understand the use of USB 2.0 because most hard drives you can find on the market at this moment are USB 2.0.
Right.
So Nintendo just said, all right, well, people really aren't using faster than USB 2.0, so why the hell should we bother?
Yeah, and Nintendo is hardly interested in future-proofing their hardware.
Yeah, I mean, they've never future-proofed anything, so why would they start now?
Yeah, they'd rather wait until everybody is bitching and moaning and then go back and sort of retrofit it with something.
Oh, I want to hear what Guillaume has to say about the Wi-Fi dongle.
The Wi-Fi dongle, you can't use it with Windows 7, and you never will.
Nope. Well... Have I spoken about the Wi-Fi dongle on the show before? I'm pretty sure I have.
A long time ago.
Yeah, because I owned one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was only compatible with XP. Not compatible with XP. It was singularly compatible with XP. It is the most fucking insane device I've ever owned. And I'm sad I don't have it anymore, but I gave it to somebody who needed it when I actually got Wi-Fi. Like, I'm going to ask for it back because they're worth a crap ton of money now because Nintendo couldn't make them anymore.
Are they really? I think I have one around somewhere in a box.
I think I threw one in the garbage.
Ah!
Man, I might make some coin off of this thing. This useless piece of shit.
Yeah, because basically they just weren't allowed to make them anymore.
Huh. They're like their licensing, like a Tetris DS thing.
No, the company that made them, Buffalo, they couldn't make them anymore because they lost the right. It wasn't a matter of lost the rights. They should have never made them. Like, they were infringing on someone else's copyrights.
Okay.
Huh.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a device that, like, kind of made sense in 2005,
That makes no goddamn sense now.
Well, a lot of people didn't have Wi-Fi routers. They, you know, routers were expensive and they're hard to set up. And, you know, so the idea of you could buy this little thing and plug it in a computer that you already have, and you have pseudo Wi-Fi that your DS can connect to so you can play Mario Kart DS online, it was appealing to a certain, you know, portion of the population.
I actually, like, I saw it on sale, and I bought it specifically because I was tired of changing between WPA and WEP, trying to access the store in Dragon Quest IX. I thought I was being smart. I was like, haha, I'm going to cheat the system. And nope. Windows 7. Too futuristic.
Yeah, well, actually, you can get them for, the cheapest I see online right now is $40 used.
Holy shit.
I was sitting on the gold mine.
I gotta find that little guy.
So that the funny thing about that thing is, it's still like, if you have a 3DS and you boot it up, it still asks if you have one of those.
Yeah.
It's like, how many people on Earth have one of these freaking things?
Yeah.
Oh, it's, I want to hook my 3DS up to it just to say I did. just so my 3DS can be like, really? Seriously? What the
F? You should get an accomplishment in the Street Pass Plaza for connecting through the Buffalo USB wireless adapter.
There will probably be an alert that goes off at Nintendo headquarters if I connect via that thing. Whoa! What the fuck?
It's like Cerebro. It's like, we found a mutant. We must go collect him now.
Like, they'll have a meeting. They'll be like, what in the hell?
Reggie's wearing his tinfoil helmet in the big, you know, in the big Epcot room. And he's like, there he is. Oh, man. Okay, well, let's move on to the next question.
Oh, let's move on.
Sure. Yes. James, why don't you read this one?
Mike writes, they dissolved, comma, Project Sora and Sora Limited is gone, period. Namco had said Smash Brothers is a priority. No punctuation. What's going on? No punctuation. I just broke the writing part of the SAT.
I love the urgency of this email.
so can I just react to the urgency here, or should I start answering? I mean, this email reads like it came from the trenches of Verdun.
It's a telegraph.
I was thinking it was strapped to a bird's ankle.
I remember exactly where I was when I heard that Project Sora Limited had dissolved.
Well, no, Project Sora dissolved. So let's.
I think Sora Limited is, well, it's a person, right? So.
Well, let's get back to let's clarify the intel and clear up the fog of war before the Huns come back over that ridge.
It's pretty fucking confusing. So it deserves, even you know, a week later, it deserves to be addressed, I think.
So let me give some context on Project Sora. So Project Sora was the company that was created as a sort of dual project between Nintendo and Sora Limited. Sora Limited is the company founded by Masahiro Sakurai, a former Nintendo employee, to develop games as he sort of tried to break away from Nintendo.
And we should say Sora Limited is very limited indeed.
Well, so we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
So the company itself was really just a clearinghouse for Sakurai to get his ideas going. The thought was, you know, after Smash Brothers, he wanted to make a clean break from Nintendo. He left the company, started his own company, started making his own game ideas. And then Iwata came around and was like, one does not escape the net that easily. And in the end, the net result was they set up this sort of cooperative company called Project Sora. Project Sora had, well, at least on its website, was listed as having a large number of employees who worked on Kid Icarus. Now, once Kid Icarus was completed, Project Sora appears to have dissolved. Now, there's some extra information here that may make why this happened a bit more clear. Namco does this a lot. Namco Bandai does this a lot. Konami does this sometimes. A lot of the anime companies do it, which Namco Bandai actually is also an anime company. They set up these organizations called Project Blank. Usually it's like part of like the title of some property they're developing. And the idea is it's basically a holding company to sort of manage this new property through its development phases. And then the company sort of ceases to exist. It's not, I mean, it's a company on paper, but functionally, all the employees are still members of the parent companies.
Or in the case of Project Sora, I think most of them were basically contractors, right?
Yeah. A good example is so all the Dot Hack stuff. So when the first wave of Dot Hack games, TV shows, cartoons, toys came out, the various companies involved, Bandai, because Bandai was still independent at the time, Namco, Bonpresto, the manga company who wrote it, the company who produced the TV show, they all set up a project called Project Dot Hack, which was a, quote, company that was comprised of employees of the various companies involved. Once the project reached fruition, so the first wave of games came out, the first shows were out, the first mangas were out, the first toys were out, the DVDs were produced, the games were published, everything was set, that company, Project Dot Hack, ceased to exist. The employees sort of matriculated back to their companies of origin, and then they were reassembled when they made a second wave of things in a new company with the same name as the previous company. Although that company shut down, it wasn't like they just closed the door. It was basically like, okay, we're done. You can go home now. It was like they brought everybody together for one place and then for legal reasons set up a company to sort of manage the IP rights. It makes doing the business easier, even if it could be confusing for the outside consumer. And as near as I can figure, Project Sora existed to create Kid Icarus. I mean, it started winding up the right time, and then it's shutting down at the right time. As near as I can figure, that's what this was. Nintendo owns the rights to Kid Icarus, and by owning the company producing the Kid Icarus game, they were able to maintain that right without having to transfer it to a third party, i.e. Sakurai.
Yeah, maybe over Dot Hack, maybe a more relevant example of this to Nintendo fans would be the company that Nintendo set up with, crap, what's his name, the Final Fantasy guy.
Yeah, Brownie Brown.
No, not Brownie Brown. That's a totally different thing. I'm talking about, do you remember, this was like the biggest day ever for Planet GameCube. It's back in 2002, I believe, when we got the news that Square Enix was going to bring Final Fantasy to GameCube. Now, the way they were doing it was, a Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles, which we knew nothing about at the time. We just knew it was a...
Right, we're like, oh, Final Fantasy, oh my god! Yeah.
We knew it was a thing, but we lost our shit because, you know, they had obviously skipped over the entire N64 generation.
Yeah, and then really they had just stopped spotting the GBA relatively soon to that point. I mean, it had been shitsville.
So what we later found out is the reason that Square Enix agreed to do this, and this was like a special project by Yamauchi, right? He was like...
Yeah, the Game Designer Studio, yes.
Thank you. I couldn't find the name of it because it's such a generic name that I could not find it on our website. Yes.
Yes, I remember it now. It just hit me now, the Game Designer Studio. I remember laughing about it.
Which is exactly the kind of like shadow company that you're talking about. It didn't really exist. It didn't really have any employees.
It's a shell company. Yeah.
It was a like a legal mechanism through which Square Enix and Nintendo formed a partnership that allowed them to shift the money around and get games published on Nintendo platforms. And it had to do partly with the fact that at the time, well, this is no longer the case, but at the time, Square Enix was significantly owned by Sony.
Well, yeah, not just that, though. Part of the deals they had made with Sony was Sony had an exclusive contract to get to Square Enix produced titles.
There you go.
So this is basically just a way to give Sony the middle finger. I mean, like, yeah, we have a contract, but fuck you, the Game Designer Studio doesn't.
Right, yeah. So instead of Square Enix making games for Nintendo, Game Designer Studio made games for Nintendo. Of course...
Using only Square Enix employees.
Right, exactly. So it's a shadow company. It doesn't really exist. And we later realized that the main reason they did this, not because they felt so passionately that they wanted to put Final Fantasy on GameCube, they wanted to put Final Fantasy on GBA. And the only way that Yamauchi would let them do that is if they committed to also making a game for GameCube. Pretty ingenious. And it worked, you know. I mean, the GBA games made way more money than Crystal Chronicles ever did.
Oh, and God, yeah. They made bank.
Yeah, so Square got what they wanted, and Nintendo got what they wanted. But yeah, same thing. I mean, you remember in the NES days even, you know, Nintendo had this policy that third parties could only release X number of games per year.
Oh, yes.
Because they felt like this was a kind of quality control. It meant that the market wouldn't get flooded like it had for the Atari 2600. And so they wanted to limit the number of games that publishers could release on the system.
And I'll just found 8 companies.
Ultra made the best Ninja Turtles games.
Exactly. So Konami created a shadow company called Ultra, which was exactly the same employees and all the same, you know, executives and everything. It was just a name on a piece of legal document.
Yeah.
And it allowed them, because it was technically a separate company, even though all the people were the same, it let them release twice as many games on the NES.
By the way, if you're trying to learn the history of that era, just don't. It's fucking confusing.
It's confusing. Not worth it. Absolutely it is. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, that's not the only thing, but there was a lot of confusion that came out of that rule.
Yeah.
You ended up with companies merging with themselves at some point. You're just like, well, fuck you. I don't want to deal with this world anymore. I don't want to live in the world where Konami merges with Ultra when he already owns Ultra. Don't need that. Get that out of here.
Did you notice when the Final Fantasy movie tanked and Sony divested themselves of Square Enix, or, well, Square at the time,
yeah,
that the game designer studio suddenly was no longer spoken of ever again until this day?
Because there's no reason. I mean, there was no reason to. Square could do whatever the hell they wanted.
It never really existed in the first place. So that's basically what Project Sora is as well.
All right. So I think that one of the reasons why Mike wrote this is because, let's clear one thing. Like, Kid Icarus did not bomb, right?
No.
It probably performed well enough to cover its...
They didn't intend to make a sequel, and Sakurai has said that. He doesn't really think it's appropriate to make a sequel to Uprising. He doesn't want to, and they don't have the bandwidth to do it anyway. And ultimately what it reveals, and this was sort of hinted at the time that Project Sora was created and Kid Icarus was announced, the studio was basically invented to make this one game. They never intended for the company to make anything after Kid Icarus was made. So once it was made, the company was dissolved.
So Project Sora came into being before they announced Kid Icarus, though.
But this is the only game they ever worked on. The studio was announced before the game was announced, but
right.
They're one and the same essentially. It might as well have been called Project Kid Icarus Uprising.
Which if Bandai were involved is what it would have been called. they lay all of their cards on the table when they create these shell companies, and they actually do it a lot. Especially their anime production division. They'll set up these projects for pretty much every major initiative.
And it, you know, there may be tax shelter reasons. There could be all kinds of weird Japanese legal system.
There are reasons intrinsic in the Japanese legal system that I'm not going to go into that deal with employment. But there's lots of weird employment law in Japan, you know, about protecting your employees. That if you just dissolve the company every time, it's a lot easier to get around. But the other reason for Nintendo's sake here, though, is probably got more to do with controlling the Kid Icarus brand than anything. I mean, by setting up this shell company that they still own, at no point do they have to transfer production rights to anybody else. It all stays in house in their own team. They own everything. It's you know, they could offshoot and have that company make those Kid Icarus animated sequences. It could manage it all in house. It's not that different from what they do at the Pokemon Company, really.
Right. I was going to ask about that. Like, it's the same kind of a deal?
A bit. It's
the Pokemon Company doesn't make video games.
No. They're clearing house for the brand. Really. I mean, stuff comes in, they stamp it, and then it goes out. I mean, but it's the same. It's a similar concept. It's a thing that exists to manage the legal peculiarities of a situation, really.
That's why when people say, like, you know, the Pokemon is co-owned by Nintendo and the Pokemon Company, I'm like, who do you think owns the Pokemon Company? Nintendo. Pokemon is owned by Nintendo. You can put a lot of nuance on that because of these weird machinations they've set up. But Nintendo owns Pokemon. Don't ever let anybody convince you otherwise.
Yeah, the thing with the Pokemon Company, why it needs to exist for Pokemon and not, say, for Mario, is that Pokemon itself is a branding machine, and by having an independent entity manage the branding and the sale of that branding, it's much easier.
Yes.
You know, it would overwhelm Nintendo's internal teams if they had to manage Pokemon. They would be crushed by it. But by having an independent company handle it, that can be all they focus on, and they'll be okay.
It's basically a room full of lawyers.
So, yeah. So, his other alert from the front reads, Namco had said Smash Brothers is a priority. Yes, it is a priority for Namco. They are putting effort into making Smash Brothers.
Well, yeah, and this comes from an interview with the director or producer of Tekken Tag 2, a game that is coming to Wii U, and he's saying, yeah, like, they're pulling people off our team to go work on Smash Brothers. It's like, let me tell you why. It's because Smash Brothers is going to sell about 10 times as many copies as Tekken Tag Tournament 2 or any other fucking fighting game that Namco releases in the next 3 years. I mean, even Brawl is massively successful. Melee is one of the most highest-selling video games of all time.
On the GameCube, no less.
And if Namco knows what's good for them, they will put a lot of resources into this game.
Harada has a history of saying things to interviews that are designed to be inflammatory. So, like, this is the guy who got in a fake war with the Street Fighter producer.
Yoshiro Ono?
Well, Ono was the Street Fighter producer. He's no longer employed by Capcom.
No.
Capcom is chasing away all of their creators one by one.
Yeah, I mean, he's the kind of guy who will make commentary on other developers' games just because it makes him seem he seems to enjoy the infamy it gets him. So I wouldn't be too worried about what he says. And I wouldn't be surprised if they've pulled a handful of people off. I can't imagine they're pillaging the Tekken Tag Tournament 2 team because that's a relatively big game for them. They can manage both projects.
It's also an acknowledgement, I think, that they're looking at sales of things like Marvel vs. Capcom 3, especially the expanded version of it, Street Fighter Cross Tekken, not a big hit, and they're on the hook supposedly to make a Tekken Cross Street Fighter at some point, and a lot of people are thinking that's just going to get straight up canceled because they don't think there's enough market interest to make it worth the development cost.
For Harada, that's a problem because Ono made the other one. This is Harada's baby.
Right. That's his next game after Tekken Tag 2. I think, you know, there's a lot of apathy towards Tekken Tag 2. I don't know that's a game that anybody really wanted.
No, in fact, the other one, Street Fighter X Tekken, was the one that people wanted. And his version, Tekken X Street Fighter, isn't really all that wanted. The Tekken Tag Tournament 2 has its audience. I mean... Yeah. There are people who love
Tekken
that
6
series.
Was not a big hit. Tekken for 3DS was not a big hit. The Tekken for PSP was a bomb. Tekken is in dire straits. It has been on the wane for a long time. It's probably a little more popular in Japan, but it's not Street Fighter. And even Street Fighter is struggling right now to keep up with, you know, they released Street Fighter 4 and it was a big hit. And Capcom thought, aha, let's go back to releasing 4 fighting games every year. And they very quickly realized that you still can't do that.
And Street Fighter is at 4. I mean, this letter, I mean, now that we've, you know, made sure he's aware that the Austro-Hungarians aren't coming over the ridge, we can invest ourselves here a little bit. And that Street Fighter 4 actually was, you know, a project of love by Yoshinori Ono, and he had to convince Capcom to make it. And then once they made it, you know, it sort of reignited that brand briefly. And I think it's smart for Namco to put resources on to Smash Brothers because in part, you know, they might learn things from making this game themselves. I mean, they probably want to get as many people exposed to this game as they can internally because you can gain a certain amount of knowledge working on a project like this. This will be good for the people who make this game, in theory.
Yeah, and again, I say it's just going to make them a shitload of money. I mean, especially compared to Tekken Tag 2, which I don't think is going to be a big hit. I really don't.
And I wouldn't be surprised at all if Namco wants to get their people in this game so they can kind of understand the design process. Because, you know, you can bang on Sakurai for some things in his game design. There are holes in his talent tree.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
But... Yes. He is probably the closest thing to an auteur I can think of in the Nintendo stable right now.
Well, as an active auteur, because Miyamoto doesn't really develop games anymore, so.
But, you know, even Miyamoto doesn't have quite the same, like, this is a Sakurai game. Like, you hand me a Sakurai game, I could tell you he made it.
Well, I would say that's a good thing. I mean, I think Miyamoto is more versatile than Sakurai.
Oh, he is. Right? But I mean, like, Sakurai knows what he wants in game design, and I think there's probably people at any company who could learn something from him.
Yeah, and the really crazy thing about this is, you know, there was when at the Nintendo Direct a few weeks ago when they announced Namco Bandai was helping with the Smash Brothers games. There's a lot of thought of, well, maybe Project Sora is doing
the 3DS version,
and maybe Namco's making the console version, so they're going to talk to each other and cooperate that way. Or maybe Project Sora is sort of leading the development, and they're doing the design, and then Namco Bandai will do the more the execution, the full production of it, you know, and so they'll work together that way. And what we now realize is Namco Bandai is doing both versions, all of them, because Sakurai is Sora Limited is one man.
It might be him, his attorney, and a secretary, to be fair.
So this partnership between Nintendo and Namco Bandai is, it in effect, it's much more like the GameCube partnerships, you know, like F-Zero GX or Star Fox Assault.
Or the Wii Smash Brothers.
Nintendo sort of produced the game. In this case, Sakurai is sort of a stand-in for Nintendo, even though he's not technically their employee. But he's representing Nintendo's interests in the Smash Brothers game. But the games, apparently both versions, will be effectively developed entirely by Namco Bandai. So the interesting thing to me is it's not necessarily like Namco Bandai is sending their employees over to learn from the masters, because it's really on their shoulders to do it. But it's experience with a storied franchise and exposure to, like you said, a singular personality in Sakurai. And ultimately, there will be some production oversight on Nintendo's behalf that, if you look back at games like Geist and Eternal Darkness, is not anything to sneeze at.
No. And I wouldn't be surprised if Nintendo sends a handful of producers over that go, you know, embed with the Namco people.
Sure.
These could be Sakurai handpicked lieutenants that just go. I mean, I'm sure he knows everybody at Nintendo right now.
What about, like, people on the lower rungs? There's no chance for them to just end up at Namco Bandai, I suppose? Like, programmers and, you know, low-level designers, artists?
What do you mean, from Project Sora?
Artists I could see coming over, and designers, and maybe some low-level designers. Programmers, I don't know. I mean, Namco Bandai has a stable of programmers that they could run on their own. I mean, they produce massive games, so I mean they certainly have the capacity to do it themselves.
But you would think that perhaps like the guys at Sora would know a little bit better the architecture of the 3DS than Namco would.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if some of the Sora employees were also Nintendo employees.
Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any tragedy in this Project Sora dissolution story.
No, I think if Nintendo came across anybody they really wanted at a Project Sora, they already got them.
Yeah, no one lost their jobs here. I mean, these people were contractors, so the contract ended.
No one is scrambling to get, you know, insurance or anything?
Well, no, well, you're in Japan, you have insurance, so it's fine.
Right.
Yeah. But no, I don't think so. I think this is a case of the people working on that game were probably much more aware of the reality of the, you know, the temporary nature of this team than we were. I think they probably were not blindsided by this at all. And look, they now have on their resume, they worked on one of the best 3DS games.
Sure.
One of the most technically impressive 3DS games that sold really well. So as contract employees, again, they're not really unemployed now. They're just, their contract ended. It's not like they lost their jobs. If they want to go get a new contract or a new permanent employment position at a company like Nintendo or Namco Bandai, they're in a great position to do so. So this is not like one of these horror stories in American development where studios are just shut down out of the blue, everybody's caught off guard, and all of a sudden you got 500 people who have no insurance and are frantically searching for the next paycheck. I don't think this is that kind of situation.
No, and you know, like I said, I wouldn't. And it's probably safe to assume Nintendo pillaged at least some of these people that they thought, you know, we want to keep this guy around, we want to keep that guy around.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised at all if some of these people end up as contractors on Smash Bros. In fact, I would be shocked if a bunch of them didn't.
Or even just permanent employees. I mean, you know, that's very common, is corporations will use contractors as sort of a farm system where, I mean, my dad used to do this. He was a manager at a utility company, and they would bring in contractors, and the ones he really liked, he would recommend them for, you know, for permanent employment by the corporation. So that's pretty common.
Yeah. So I think we've answered the Kaiser's call pretty well here. So I think we can move on.
Hope so. All right. So Guillaume has the next email.
Hamid writes, Nintendo has been showing us games that are going to be released reasonably soon. They claim that the competition tends to copy their ideas. I feel that they lose the opportunity to collect feedback from you guys and make some adjustments before they release the final product. I mean, do you think they'll have the time to adjust the gamepad controls for Pikmin 3 and not use motion for aim? What do you guys think about this new trend from Nintendo?
Between E3 and now, I mean, they have time to make changes. They do. But no, it's not that new. Now, what we don't get is we aren't getting, like, here's a look at what cel-shaded, toon-shaded Link will look like 3 years from now. So, yeah, they did actually adopt some feedback from that character. And from the...
Really?
They changed his eyes a bit, if I recall correctly. They made them more expressive. And they made them more lively. He follows things with them.
Yeah, they also realized that the rest of the world needs to be really colorful for this cartoon look to be pulled off. And it may just be that the part of the game they showed when they first showed Toon Link, Chibi Link, as we were calling him at the time, it was back in 2000.
Mm-hmm, it's 2001.
Yeah. And everybody freaked out. If you remember, they showed a scene from the fortress, which was very dark, and it was like, what are you guys doing? And when the game clicked, and when everybody started to, or most people, including myself, started to roll over towards really falling in love with that art style, is at E3 in 2002, when they first showed the outdoor environments, they showed the ocean, they showed the sun, and the wind, and the mountains and the trees, and that's when everybody was like, oh shit, this is beautiful.
Yeah.
The first footage they showed of that game was not very pretty. You know, it was weird, but it wasn't pretty.
And you couldn't really get a feel for what they were going for either.
Yeah. So I don't know if that was an adjustment based on feedback or if it was just a bad debut.
I would imagine, I mean, there were some adjustments in that game physically. You could see them if you go back and look at the very first screenshots. Not that we have them, because back then we couldn't post screenshots.
Hey, I remember when Double Dash was first playable. This was at E3 2003.
Oh, IGN, I think, tried to take credit a little bit for that, or...
Well, everybody who played it said, man, this is too slow. It's too slow. And, you know, that game came out... probably five months later, and it was very noticeably faster, even on like 50cc. It was just dramatically improved, and everybody was like, oh, okay, now it's fine. So this happens all the time. You know, Nintendo is very perceptive about these things, and E3 is very valuable, I think, to them, because their games aren't commonly demoed outside of events like E3, you know. They don't have a lot of press junkets where they bring in a bunch of people to play their games. They just don't do that very often.
Hmm. So, like, what happened in this situation, like Donkey Kong Country Returns, where they had the waggle to roll? Like, did they lack time to change, or, like, were they just not going to change the controls, whatever people playing the demo said?
Let's put it this way. You can hack controllers in using OS boot. So I would imagine they just...
That's how easy it is.
Yeah, I would imagine they just said, no, we're not going to do that.
Right.
Yeah, they willfully ignored people saying, I don't like waggle.
And they felt, for whatever reason, I think they were completely wrong and misguided, but they felt strongly, or someone who calls the shots did, felt very strongly that that was the right decision, and they stuck with it. And, you know, I played that E3 demo with Brian Walker, the producer of the game and also of the Metroid Prime series, standing right next to me asking me what I thought.
I remember this conversation.
And were you there? I was like, this is awesome. You should really put in a button to roll. And he's like, okay, thanks for the feedback. I mean, that's basically, he said something like that. You know, I mean, they were listening, but ultimately they disagreed with us.
And you know what? You're probably the 50th person to suggest that day.
Yeah, exactly. I take no credit for, even if they had changed, I wouldn't take credit for it, because, you know, I think he just, I think he heard that a lot.
Because his response indicated they had heard that a lot.
He might have completely agreed with me. He might have been overruled by Kensuke Tanabe or Miyamoto, you know, for that matter. So, you know, there's a lot of people that go into making these games, and the feedback, however good and correct it may be, may not always be incorporated for that reason, you know. Nintendo has plenty of bullheaded game designers and producers who just disagree.
Including the president of the company.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, we can forget sometimes. He himself is a game designer, and some of his Iwata asks, you can kind of see where he made more than casual suggestions to developers. Because they'll be like, yeah, I came in and I thought that was like this, this, and this. And you're like, oh, I wonder if that made it into the game. I bet it did.
Yeah, when the CEO or the president says, hey, I think you should do this, you're probably going to take direction.
Like, obviously, I don't have a lot of experience with this whole thing, but I do have I can't boast to have a lot of contacts, but I might have a contacts within Nintendo who told me that they had, basically, during E3, a team that only, like, scoured the internet to look at different impressions and different reactions on message boards. And supposedly, you know, they looked at my review, my preview of New Super Mario Bros. 2. But that did not, like, they weren't looking for something that would inform them on what to change in the game. They were looking for a better way to present it to people.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
It was specifically in order to better market it and to present it in a better light.
And I think New Super Mario Bros. 2 is weird because that game probably was too close to make any significant changes. I mm-hmm. mean,
yeah.
That game is being showed way late.
It is coming out next month.
Yeah, and I mean, and they only showed it the last day of E3.
Yeah, that's a very unusual case for such a high-profile game.
Yeah, and to an extent, they don't really need to get much feedback on New Super Mario Bros. 2 because it's fucking New Super Mario Bros.
Yeah.
They know what
they're
doing.
They're going to sell 20 million copies of it no matter what. Right. So,
well, and it's not like they're going to change because what we say, they've made this game before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But for a lot of other things, you know, I think they're right to do that. I mean, if you go back a couple episodes and listen to our reaction to E3 and our follow up to it, it's more about the messaging than it is the content. You know, I mean, I think we all agree there were some fantastic games that Nintendo showed at E3, a lot of them they didn't really show. We had to go dig them out of the closet, you know. And so I think the messaging and you know, selectively deciding what to focus on and how to explain the new system and the new games to people is absolutely what they need a lot of help with. So I'm glad that they're doing that. And I don't necessarily want them to change anything about Pikmin 3. I just want them to show me what's new about it.
And you know, when I played the 3DS for the first, not the first time, because we did that stupid trophies thing, but when I played the 3DS properly for the first time, you know, I had Nintendo people, you know, talk to me afterwards and ask me, like, you know, very, not leading questions, but very, you know, irregular questions. Not the kind that you just ask somebody casually, but, you know, very probing questions about immediate response. And you could tell what they were thinking. It was about trying to make decisions about what they're going to do down the road dealing with the general audience.
Yeah.
And even though it was, the 3DS was pretty soon going to come out. It wasn't right away, but it was, you know, there was, what, 10 months at that point? Less than 10 months. Like, seven or eight. I mean, they obviously weren't going to make any hardware changes, but they were, you know, they needed to know how to start marketing this thing. And I mean, that was really all the time they had, was that time frame, and they were really trying to use it the best they could.
The first GameCube game I ever played was Melee, and this was at E3 2001.
Really?
Yes, it was the first demo that I went to. And in fact, I was had been in line for hours ahead of the show opening. So I was literally the first person to walk up to the demo station and start playing it. So I was one of the first people outside of Nintendo to ever play Melee. And when I got done with my demo, in which the designer of the game, I believe it was Sakurai, I didn't know him at the time. I didn't know who he was.
Well, he looked about 20 years older than he does now anyway. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause he's aging backwards. But I know for a fact that one of the producers or the director of the game was playing against me playing as Bowser and wiped the fucking floor with me. Of course, I'd never even played against Bowser before. He wasn't in the original game, so I had no idea what to do against him. But anyway, I played the game for a few minutes, and as I walked away from it, there was a young lady there from HAL Laboratories. It's the only person from HAL who I've ever met outside of an interview. But she spent 2 or 3 minutes interviewing me about my experience playing the game. I mean, this is someone from, not even from Nintendo, from HAL, who was developing the game in Japan. And she asked me what I thought and, you know, what was my favorite thing, that kind of stuff. I mean, this is you know, over 10 years ago. So Nintendo always does this. They do it in a very low key way. You know, they're not Konami inviting 50 American journalists out to a hotel in Japan or Hawaii so they can play Metal Gear for all weekend and then like write essays to the, you know, to the designer about what they think should change or how much they love it. I mean, that's a bizarre, extreme case. But...
You know, and you can go back to the episode, not the last time we had Billy on, but the time before that when he talked about what he did. I mean, his role writing these basically phantom reviews for the company who makes the game. I mean, there's a certain amount of feedback pursuit in that too. You don't need to necessarily stage these games at big massive events to get feedback from outside the company.
Oh, sure. And they do focus testing and stuff like that. You know, Retro Studios does a lot of focus testing. And, you know, sometimes they bring in like family members, sometimes they bring in local people and just swear them to secrecy under the penalty of death. But they do this. Retro Studios is wholly owned by Nintendo. So I would assume, you know, EAD probably does the same thing in Japan and we just never hear about it. But they do this. And it's exactly the same process. They have people play the game and they watch them play it and they videotape the entire thing and they ask them lots of questions, have them fill out, you know, forms and do video interviews and then sit around a table and discuss it amongst themselves. And they take all this very seriously.
Watch them through a see-through mirror.
Oh, yeah.
Focus testing now is actually really sophisticated. There are really advanced tools that can really gauge what the person's feeling without asking them. And you can actually get second-by-second impressions of what a person thinks of the game just by monitoring biometrics. I mean,
they also track like everything you do in the game and like build up these crazy statistical analyses of which direction you walked in and how long did it take you to find a certain thing. And they just pore over this data because it's invaluable to them. Because the thing is, they know the game. They make it. They know it too well. Like they can't objectively criticize it. So.
We actually do this internally with the company I work for. We do this with our marketing materials. We'll present marketing and surreptitiously, right at the time, we're monitoring the person using biometric systems and, you know, cameras that can determine where eyes are looking and things like that. And second, like microsecond by microsecond, map out their reaction to a 30-second ad. And they may change like 5 frames as a response of it. But that 5 frames may prove to be immensely invaluable to the overall efficacy of the ad.
I'm just picturing the Voigtkamp test right now.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good imagery right there.
Just trying to find out if people are replicants.
If you play Nintendo games and it feels like they made decisions without understanding what you as the player expected or wanted out of it, it's not because they weren't listening or they don't actually know what you want. I think they're very aware. They do a lot of research and they know exactly what you expect and what you want. They just don't care.
Fuck you.
And I say that in all seriousness. They're very bull. You know, we all know this. All fans know this. Nintendo's very bullheaded. They do what they want to do. They trust their instincts and they're willing to give you something that you don't necessarily want in the hopes that you will try it and discover that you love it. And in a sense, because they're a creative, innovative company, they have to do that. They have to take those risks and say, you know, we're not going to give you exactly what you want all the time. We're going to give you the things you didn't even know that you wanted until you tried them.
Coins, coins, coins.
That's part of why they're amazing and part of why they're incredibly frustrating. But, you know, it's not that they don't collect feedback from us. I think they just ignore a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of just the way these things go. I mean, Nintendo doesn't necessarily need E3 to know what the games need. I mean, they could focus test it internally too. They could, one division could hand over their game to another division and say, go play it. I mean, they won't have the day-to-day intimacy with this game to be in that, you know, I'm too close to the source to know what's wrong with it philosophy. I mean, these will be people who can articulate the issues with the game. Like they're game developers themselves. They know what they're doing. They can look at it and say, yeah, that needs to be changed.
Well, look, Miyamoto does this all the time, right? These are games that he is not directly involved with on a day-to-day basis, but they bring him in and they have him play it and they just meticulously obsess over every single word that he says. And they sometimes will just totally redesign the entire game based on his feedback. You think they give a shit what we think when they've got Miyamoto down the street? They say, dude, come in on Tuesday. We want you to play our demo and tell us what you think. That's better than 1,000 focus testers.
Yeah, I mean, But not even just Miyamoto. You could, I mean, they could bring in, like, let's say it's not a Sakurai game. They could bring him in. They could bring Iwata in. I mean, like I said, he's a game developer. He knows what he's doing. They could bring, I mean, I guarantee you everything Nintendo publishes is in Iwata's hands at some point.
Mm. Well, even Yamauchi had, like, final say, right? So he didn't, like, play it in the interim. He wanted them...
He made someone watch. He watched someone playing it, yes.
Right, he wouldn't play it himself. He would wait until the game was completely finished, and you'd have this moment of truth where you walk in his office. I love it. In David Sheff's book, he talks about this. It's so funny. And he'll come in, and you have to show him. He'll make you play it, or he'll make someone else play it, so he'll watch it. And then he just says yes or no.
And that's if he says no, the game's dead. It's over.
Go home.
Yeah, there's no take it back and work on it. It's done.
Yeah. So I think the modern version is much better.
But I mean, like there's the three-headed monster that makes Zelda games now. I mean, you know, it's executive producer, it's producer, and it's director. I mean, you could bring any of them in. You could bring in the guys from EAD Tokyo. I mean, there are a lot of people. You could bring in Tezuka, for God's sake. I mean, there are people at Nintendo who know what the hell's going on. You could bring in to play your games. They focus to test the shit out of everything. I mean, there's a reason the narrative of Miyamoto flipping over the tea table came out. It wasn't because he was making these games. These were games he wasn't making that he came in and said, nope, start over.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if it was his game, he wouldn't have to flip over the tea table. He'd just change his mind.
And you know, last week when I talked about Super Mario Galaxy and how I felt that the difficulty curve ramped up a little bit too quickly for beginners, you know, where does it break? Like, where does the process kind of fail at some point? Like, is it because perhaps, like, they tested it too internally? Like, do these developers, like, even though they're very, you know, experienced and know what they're doing, like, do they have, like, can they be blind to this kind of thing?
I think, Guillaume, I mean, I wasn't there to respond last week, but I don't think that's a failure on Nintendo's part. I think the fact that your girlfriend had trouble with that part, I think Nintendo's response would be, well, you guys were playing it together. Why didn't you help her?
You're a terrible boyfriend.
No, because it's a Mario game, I think they feel like they can make it almost as hard as they want to because they know that people play Mario games with family members and friends present, and they will get together and put their heads together and figure out a way past it, just like we did when we were kids, where we would trade the controller off to a friend and say, can you help me get past this part?
Yeah, but
maybe that's an antiquated idea, but I think that's really what they expect, especially with Co-Star mode, which is a very explicit help me mode.
Johnny's mythical Nintendo has just questioned Guillaume's relationship skills.
But that's basically what happened, though. Like, I mean, like, she did beat that boss, but afterwards, like, she was like, you know what, I'd be happy to watch you play through the game. So I picked up the controller, and at that point, I think the game had lost her.
Well, and also, I think they would consider that a completely valid outcome of the situation, is that one person got exhausted, and they handed it off to someone else, and they took over for a while. And you probably didn't keep playing much longer, but you've also played through the entire game already.
But yeah, like I you know, like I don't think there was any going back to the game after that.
No, I can understand. I mean, maybe the difficulty curve does go up too hard, and sometimes it can be hard to figure out what the pacing of a difficulty curve should be, because you have to make sure people who get it quickly or already had it don't get bored. I mean, people can be tolerant of a game that gets started slowly and say, oh, well, it's got to get started for people who are new to this. But I think people's patience is actually much less than they believe it to be. And I can base this on myself playing these games and thinking, well, I'll give this game time to get started, and then almost immediately being impatient with it.
Yeah, Skyward Sword was that way for me. I was like...
Yes! So, I mean, I said, okay, Skyward Sword's really doing things differently, so I can understand it's going to start slowly. But then I was mad at it almost immediately for being slow. And it's like, yeah, I know. I just told myself I'd do it, but I don't care.
It's like, we were hardly surprised that game takes a while to ramp up, you know?
No.
But still.
It went overboard.
Right. And we knew it. I mean, we were going into it saying, this is our plan. We intend to stick along.
Yeah. Hey, we've been around this block before, you know? But still, it's like, oh, come on, guys. Really?
Yeah. I mean, me, like, I was bored of Sunshine while he was still on the fucking plane. I'm like, just get started. Yeah. My God!
Well,
go.
Also that entire cutscene is just should not be in the game.
No,
it's completely pointless.
I challenge anyone listening right now to go back and watch that cutscene. It's mental. It is so insane. You're just like, what is going on right now?
Yeah, it's really, truly awful for a wonderful game. So that is going to do it for...
Well, hold on. Actually, before we wrap up, I did some research on our last question that I want to point out one inaccuracy we made that's even crazier than what we said before. So we were discussing the Game Designers Studio, Inc., that Square Enix set up alongside Nintendo. Square owned, or just Square at the time. Square owned 51% of the company, the Game Designers Studios, Inc. And when they merged with Enix, they acquired the remainder of it. And then they renamed it Squex Corporation. S-Q-E-X.
Really?
Corporation. The company didn't cease to exist. They just renamed it. And then in 2005, when Square Enix bought Taito, they merged Taito with Squex and renamed it to Taito Corporation. So actually, the Game Designers Studio, Inc. still exists as part of Taito.
Holy shit.
Wow.
Yeah. Also, I like the name Squex.
Squex.
S-Q-E-X.
I wonder if that was affected by the Eidos acquisition / merger a couple years ago. Square Enix has become an enormous company. Holy shit, they're huge.
They are. And quickly, very, very quickly. The merger with Enix was actually really good for them.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre. I mean, it's a really strange company at this point that you know, whatever. Whatever works for you guys and Squex. Whatever works for you, Squex.
That's going to wrap up our listener mail this week. Thank you so much, everybody, for writing in. And the email address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We would love to hear from you. Just another quick reminder, in case you forgot from the top of the show, it seems so long ago now. We will be off next week for a little summer vacation time. But keep refreshing your feed. You might find something or other. We're trying to come up with some kind of substitute that we can actually pull off with our reduced resources. Of course, during our gap, it's a great time to pimp one of our sister podcasts, NWR Connectivity, because I'm sure they will continue to publish next week just like they do every week. So if you don't have a new RFN to listen to, it's a good time to go over and check out Connectivity if you have not already, because they talk about Nintendo too. So go do that. And we are hardly oblivious to the upcoming episode 300 apocalypse. We have some pretty solid ideas for what we're going to do, I think, but we should have solicited this a while back. But since we do have a couple weeks to go, I just want to throw out there, if you have any ideas, any special requests, any special wishes, or thoughts you want to send our way for episode 300, maybe some stuff we can read out on the show, maybe some stuff that we might be able to pull together in a fairly short time frame.
Preferably not something that requires tons of editing, please.
That's right. Yes. Make it easy. The easier you make it, the more likely it is we will do it.
Because we're lazy.
That's right. If you have any ideas, we would love to hear those as well. You can shoot them over the email or put them in TalkBack in the forums, where you will also find the official retroactive forum thread for Wario Land 4. You can start discussing that amongst yourselves and with us as well for a future episode feature. That's all. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks, hopefully with John and everybody. And that'll be our last episode before the big 300 shindig. So I look forward to it. Hope everyone's enjoying your summer break, and we will too in this next week. Thanks for listening. Be back soon. Bye.
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 Okay, but what if I don't care about Felicia Day?
Well, then...
nice.
Yes.
But also, how could you not care about Felicia freaking Day? She's cute as hell.
I got a picture of myself with her.
Really?
Yeah, but I can't show it to anyone.
So it's a Photoshop
job. It might
job.
Be a little dirty.
There's so many ways to take the commentary, but I can't show it to
Photoshop,
anyone.
Photoshop, heads placed on bodies. Do, do, do.